from the council with us. So just wanted to say welcome. Thank you for attending our 15th meeting of the Climate Action Council. As we have in the past, we're holding today's meeting via webinar as a matter of safety, as well as to allow for broad participation across the state. And I will hand it over to Farah Anderson to walk us through the procedures for today's meeting.
Thank you, Sarah. And we're able to go to the procedures slide just to follow along. Once again, as always, to ensure that we have a smooth and productive meeting, just wanted to remind council members of our logistics. There's just a few, and as we're back to virtual, I think we're relatively used to them, so I will go through them quickly. The first is to remain on mute if you're not speaking so that we can limit background noise, and the technical support team will also monitor to ensure non-speaking members are muted. Of course, if you are able, we do encourage council members to join us on video, and you can click your camera button on your computer screen to do so. It'll be gray if your video is on and red if it's not. If you would like to provide a comment or a question, please use the raise your hand function on the hand raise using the icon on your screen. And we will encourage everyone to please also lower your hand when you have completed your comment to ensure smooth tracking. Once you are called, unmute yourself so we can all hear you and place yourself back on mute afterwards. And then lastly, should anyone have any technical issues, feel free to reach out to the support team directly at nys.cac@cabinetsgroup.com. And with that, I will complete sort of our technical walkthrough and pass back to Sarah.
Great, thank you for that, Farah. So let's turn to roll call to see which members of the council are here. Can I hand it over to NYSERDA's Valerie Milanovich?
Good morning, thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. When I call your name, just please acknowledge your participation in today's Climate Action Council meeting. Co-Chair Harris.
Good morning, present.
Morning, Co-Chair Sagos.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. On behalf of Commissioner Ball, Brian Steinmuller.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Donna DeCarolis.
Good morning.
Hello. On behalf of Commissioner Dominguez, Ron Epstein.
Thanks.
I think I heard you.
Yes, good morning.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Great. Gavin Donahue.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I believe Dennis Elsenbeck may be having some IT issues, so he's intending to join, but Dennis, I don't know if you're, I don't see.
Oh, Valerie, can you hear me? I'm on.
Oh, great. Great. Welcome, Dennis. Thank you.
Thank you.
CEO Falcone.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. On behalf of Empire State Development, Vince Brabashier.
Kevin Hansen today, actually, but hello.
Oh, Kevin Hansen? Okay. Sorry, Kevin. Thank you. Rose Harvey?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Great. Thanks, Rose.
Good.
Chair Christian?
Here, but slow on the unmuting.
That's okay. Thank you. Welcome. Bob Howarth?
I'm here. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Peter Iwanowicz?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. CEO Quinones.
Present. Good morning.
Good morning. Commissioner Reardon.
Present. Good morning. Good
morning. Ann Reynolds.
I'm here. Hello.
Super. On behalf of Secretary Rosado, Keisha Santiago Martinez.
I'm here. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Raya Salter.
Good morning. Present.
Right. Paul Shepson.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Commissioner Visnauskas. Perhaps she's still trying to sign in. We'll circle back if we need to. And on behalf of Commissioner Zucker, Henry Sletoff.
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. With that, I note a presence for today's Climate Action Council meeting.
Thank you, Val. I'd also just like to officially welcome the newly appointed PSC Chair Rory Christian to the council. He's certainly no stranger to this process, as he's been a member of the Power Generation Advisory Panel for over a year. So I am sure he'll hit the ground running with the work before us here. But I would, of course, also like to thank Commissioner Howard for his contributions to the council while being interim chair. And I know I'm joined by Commissioner Sagos in saying that we look forward to continuing to engage both with Commissioner Howard, but specifically with the new PSC Chair Christian in this role. So welcome to you. If you wanted to say hello, I know we'd welcome it.
Thank you for the introduction, Doreen. I'm happy to be here. I'm glad to be a part of this process, and I look forward to working with familiar faces and new in moving the state towards its goals. So thank you for having me, and looking forward to participating.
Welcome, Rory, and you win the backdrop award, we assume here. Right off.
Definitely.
Nicely done.
Definitely.
One day I will play that guitar.
Over to you, Basil.
Great. Thanks, Doreen. You all see the agenda in front of you. The big elements today are thank you to the Climate Justice Working Group for coming back together. We're going to go through the waste, energy intensive, trade exposed industries panels, and the Just Transition Working Group. We'll hear feedback from the Climate Justice Working Group on those panels. Amanda Stevens will then jump into the updated climate assessment. And we'll hear from Carl Moss on the next set of information coming out of the integration analysis. So it should be a good meeting, as always. Next slide, please. So that will take up the meetings, the minutes from the last meeting. Is there any discussion on what we sent around? Any questions? Let's see the box here. Okay, not seeing any. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
I'll move it.
Can I have a second?
I seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, thank you. The motion is approved. The minutes are approved. Next slide, please. So Doreen and I will just spend a couple of minutes talking about Climate Week, which was very important. Climate Week, obviously, we had as usual, Climate Week in New York City, which helped to focus some of the nation's attention, if you will, on what we're up to here. Next slide, please. Action-packed week, to say the least. I'll go through some of the announcements that came on the resiliency side, and Doreen certainly has some great things to talk about on the mitigation side. The governor announced, as I think you all know, a new Resilient New York agenda, putting out $600 million of grant money for water infrastructure, which I think we all know is part of our state's long-term plan for climate resiliency, certainly after Hurricane Ida and many other storms over the years. And also announcing a new commitment on the Bond Act, which will go before the voters next year, increasing the dollar amount to $4 billion and at the same time changing its name to reflect its priorities. In addition to that, DEC also announced a community air monitoring program, which will be working with the Climate Justice Working Group and all of you, of course, community leaders over the coming months to shape that up. It'll be 10 overburdened areas around the state. And our goal, we believe, is to hit 5 million New Yorkers with that monitoring. So it's very exciting. It'll be first of its kind statewide in the country. And if it's done right, the first of its kind in the world, which is really amazing. We're going to go beyond the Climate Act. The Climate Act requires four communities, so we're going to go do 10. We're backing that up as well with a capacity grant program. And that's a $500,000, at least starting commitment from DEC through the environmental justice line of the EPF. And that'll help communities then take some of the data that's coming out of this new monitoring program and help act upon it, which is good for transparency and certainly local participation and input. So very excited about that program, and certainly more to come on that. And ending Climate Week last Saturday with Governor then traveling to Glens Falls to talk about the Climate Smart Communities program and the 11 new communities that are now certified, not just committed, but certified Climate Smart, including Glens Falls. So the state's moving forward on that great program. So over to you, Dorian.
Thank you. Next slide, please. It was truly a remarkable week of activity for Climate Week altogether, for certain. Sorry, next slide, please. It was great to see you and our new governor and lieutenant governor together crisscrossing the state, certainly with a very significant suite of impactful announcements. In addition to the activities you just mentioned, there were certainly a number of other announcements worth highlighting. First up, on Monday, Governor Hochul announced the establishment of a new distributed solar goal for New York, expanding the 6-gigawatt goal under the Climate Act to 10 gigawatts by 2030, and directing the Department of Public Service and NYSERDA to work together on the roadmap for its achievement. So it was exciting to see that momentum on the distributed side, certainly, but on the other side of the coin, on the large scale side, the governor also announced So together, this constituted not only a notable announcement that certainly merits separate discussion as time permits, certainly, but for now, I'll just note how excited I am that we were able in one day to take such significant action to achieve the goals of the Climate Act, and notably to inject renewables into the city where we need to reduce our reliance on fossil fuel generation. Full stop. So from a statewide perspective, I think the headline is really exciting to say that together with all of the contracts that we now have under development, we are going to be at more than 60% of statewide energy consumption from renewables when these projects are operational. So a big, big way to start Climate Week. And certainly two other exciting NYSERDA proposals that we were fortunate to announce alongside Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin last Thursday, which was $36 million for the Regional Clean Energy Hubs Initiative, designed to improve community engagement and ensure disadvantaged communities benefit from our clean energy transition. And this is focused on all 10 REDC regions of the state, and a very exciting opportunity to get very local with our work. Partnering with that, we also announced a $59 million investment in a new Clean Green Schools initiative, which is focusing exclusively on disadvantaged communities across the state to bring clean energy, energy efficiency, and improved air quality to P-12 schools. So I am excited at the platform that this provides. I am hopeful that it will be leveraged by pending federal dollars as well, together to really make a very significant suite of investments as we know we need to in our schools. So with that exciting week behind us and many, many more exciting weeks to come, I'll hand it back to you to get down to the agenda.
Dorian, thanks. Great job. And it was an exciting week, to say the least. So more to come, of course. Let's have the next slide, please. Okay. Climate Justice Working Group, thank you all. I know you've been working very hard on all the panels, and now we're at the last three, as I mentioned before, waste, energy intensive, and just transition. So just really grateful for all the time you put in. We'll hear your feedback today. Just a note on the waste panel, as you know, Martin Brand has been either telegraphing or explicitly stating he was going to retire, and indeed he did. Much to all of our chagrin, but he leaves a good legacy in his wake. I've asked some members from our programs to be here today to field any questions that may come up. Jared can help to flag the questions as they come forward. But thank you, Martin, if you're listening. We appreciate all your work. Great. Okay, now I'll turn it over to, I believe, Eddie. Is Eddie kicking off on the waste panel?
You should be so lucky. Good morning, folks. Actually,
we are lucky. Hi, Eddie.
Good morning. Actually, I thought we had a different lineup. I could go okay. first.
You call it, whatever you want to do.
I think we lead with our best. So I think, Raul, are you up first?
I'm happy to go first. Let's see what the slide says.
Okay, next slide.
We're going to be defined by the slides. So we'll jump. What's the first slide?
Maybe next slide.
You're on, Rawa. Okay.
There you go.
Sorry.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with all of you. I'm really actually excited to talk about the Just Transition Working Group. I think overall, we think that they did a decent job, but there are a few things that we would like to clarify. One being that under the Just Transition principles, there is the assertion to create a robust in-state low-carbon energy and manufacturing supply chain. So there needs to be clarity around what is considered low-carbon energy manufacturing, since there are concerns around biofuels and renewable natural gas. Also, when the public spending is used, a best value purchasing framework is applied in order to encourage contracts are awarded to high road manufacturers and through the supply chain. Throughout the process, the committee has not looked into the definitions of renewable energy sources in the context of a just transition framework. So as we move towards implementation of the CLCPA, the working group needs to spend more time working on the jobs analysis and energy generation, but it needs to be in a holistic way. Under the enabling initiative section, points 1, 2, and 5 address displaced workers' concerns and workforce development. While most of the recommendations are commendable and should be initiated, a workforce assessment plan would help to ensure that impacted workers contribute to the process and keep informed about possible job loss or creation. Huge principle of just transition is that the people that are closest to the problem also have the best solutions. So in addition to the recommendations only mentioned once, the idea of retirement planning, this should also be considered in the workforce assessment plan, since an aging fossil fuel reliant workforce may not want to reskill, and a dignified retirement would aid in a just transition. Next slide, please. Thank you. So on page 42, business opportunities and strategy section, an additional potential strategy to consider are community benefits agreements that can be made between manufacturers, community stakeholders, and union groups. Community benefit agreements provide a layer of community and legal accountability. On page 48, there is a recognition of displaced fossil fuel workers at existing power plants as skilled employees whose individual needs need to be assessed for retraining and planning for the future. Once again, before the plan is closed, a workforce assessment plan can help with planning for reuse of the power plant for clean energy production and manufacturing. There is an opportunity to minimize disruption of an existing workforce to transition to other clean energy opportunities. Also under point 3, in reference to hiring, it must explicitly acknowledge and name efforts to eliminate implicit bias in the search and hiring process. The financial support will be offered for businesses to address JEDI, justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. Then we must ensure these dollars are well spent, following best practices aimed at recruiting and retaining an excellent and diverse workforce. I will add one other thing in this, is that, one of the things that we see as frontline organizations, they're also trying to crack the nut of workforce development, in particular for really challenged populations in low income and communities of color, is that there has to be multiple strategies scaffolding approaches that have several layers of on-ramping these workers, and there needs to be strategic coordination and collaboration. And one of those ways is that, you know, the state agencies do their level best to work with community-based organizations, but we also need employers and businesses. We need the actual workers themselves, and we need labor unions, state agencies, and community-based organizations to be meeting more regularly so that we have a clear understanding about what are the employers looking for, making sure that we have the necessary on-ramps. And one of the things that we need is, if we want dynamic systems that are always shifting, we know that, but we need adaptive systems to unlock that change. And the state agencies need less rigidity to do the kinds of dynamic approaches that we are talking about for a just transition for our workforce. Thank you.
And I think I'm next. Can you guys hear me, see me? Okay. So I'm Abby McHugh Griffa, Executive Director of the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes Region. Very pleased to be here with you all today. And I want to begin with next slide, please. There we go. By appreciating the energy intensive and trade exposed industry panel's focus on creating 21st century clean jobs in disadvantaged communities, as well as the proposed data collection and reporting requirements that would provide a more accurate understanding of how industrial facilities impact disadvantaged communities. As with all aspects of New York State's transition to clean energy, collecting robust data and making that data publicly available will allow for meaningful evaluation of progress and challenges to ensure that we achieve the greenhouse gas emission targets of the CLCPA in an equitable manner. In addition, the recommendations aptly identify that state procurement preferences for low carbon building materials can encourage less energy intensive manufacturing in some sectors. However, we were concerned to see that the EITE panel's recommendations focus more on economic development and state assistance for EITE businesses than on the regulations that will be necessary to drive down industrial emissions as close to zero as is technically possible. Reducing emissions and advancing environmental justice must be the explicit objective of New York State's efforts to implement the CLCPA within the industrial sector and other sectors, which can support business development, but may also require tough decisions that some business leaders initially find unpalatable. And although the EITE panel's recommendations make little mention of specific technologies or energy sources, we were concerned to see more attention given to methods that would allow the sector to continue to pollute, such as carbon capture and storage and low carbon fuels, than to electrification and renewables. This suggests that the panel's priorities may require some reevaluation. In terms of what should be promoted as industry solutions under the CLCPA, we recommend strongly emphasizing demand side changes such as process efficiency, materials recycling, materials substitution, waste reduction, and improved product longevity. Fossil fuel combustion for industrial heat should be greatly reduced, replacing it with electric heat whenever feasible. A study of industries in the European Union found that around 40% of gas-fired industrial heat could be replaced by electric heat pumps, and other non-fossil fuel heating technologies can be applied for higher heat industrial processes. Regarding workforce development, it is critically important that members of disadvantaged communities are included in the process of creating workforce development programs to ensure that these programs meet the community's needs and are culturally appropriate. And of course, that's what Rawa was just referencing. Next slide, please. So although these issues are only hinted at in the EITE panel's recommendations, we wanted to take a moment to highlight some environmental justice concerns associated with carbon capture and storage, hydrogen, and offsets, which we believe should not be promoted as solutions under the CLCPA. Carbon capture and storage technologies are problematic because they encourage the continued extraction and combustion of fossil fuels. Research on actual CCS projects find that emissions reductions of only about 10 to 11% after factoring in production and process emissions related to the technologies themselves. This ineffectiveness is underscored by the exorbitant costs and risks associated with storing carbon. Even if CCS could be effective at reducing carbon emissions, local air pollution will continue and may even increase. For this reason, CCS could violate the environmental justice standards established in Section 7 of the CLCPA. Regarding efforts to replace fossil fuels with hydrogen, we understand that some industrial high heat processes, such as cement production, may not be electrifiable. In such cases, green hydrogen is a potential alternative fuel. However, nearly all hydrogen commercially available today is produced from fossil fuels, and so-called blue hydrogen, produced from fossil fuels but using CCS to reduce emissions, could actually result in net increases in greenhouse gas emissions compared to burning gas or coal fuel. And I'll just note that the Climate Action Council's very own Bob Howard has done some excellent research in this area. Combustion of hydrogen also raises serious environmental justice concerns due to higher NOx emissions, as much as 6 times higher compared to natural gas. Even industry studies find that blending hydrogen with natural gas will increase NOx emissions. Hydrogen combustion for industrial processes is no silver bullet, therefore, for replacing fossil fuels. And at a minimum, hydrogen proposals should be subject to review and possible denial under Section 7 of the CLCPA, prohibiting state actions that impose disproportionate pollution burdens on environmental justice communities. Lastly, we'd like to simply remind the Council that the CLCPA restricts the use of offsets by prohibiting waste-to-energy projects, including incineration and pyrolysis, and biofuels used for energy or transportation purposes. Any approved greenhouse gas emission offset project shall be designed to provide a discernible benefit to the environment rather than to the source, be located in the same county and within 25 linear miles of the source of emissions to the extent practicable, enhance the conditions of the ecosystem or geographic area adversely affected, and substantially reduce or prevent the generation or release of pollutants through source reduction. In approving offset projects, the state must design the alternative compliance mechanism to ensure co-pollutant reductions and maximize environmental, health, and economic benefits in environmental justice communities. And with that, I will pass it to my colleague, Eddie Bautista, who is now going to talk about the waste panel.
Can I intervene? I think there's some folks that may want to touch on either what we talked about with Just Transition or EITE before we get on to waste. Give a chance for folks to raise questions about both those. And I think Doreen and Roberta also want to just make a couple notes about Just Transition.
Thanks, Basil. It's Roberta from the DOL. I just had a couple of questions on the notes on the Just Transition Working Group. The workforce assessment plan, when you talk about a workforce, I mean, we do workforce assessment plans all the time at the DOL, but I have a feeling that we're using the same words differently. So when you talk about workforce assessment plan, are you talking about assessing the workforce and their skills and all that, or are you actually asking that the workforce themselves assess the plan? I think we're using the same words differently.
First of all, Commissioner Roberta, I want to say thank you. Language is so important, and I can tell you one thing. What you're saying is absolutely correct in that, for example, when I talk to finance, it's like we're all talking different languages, right? So I need an intermediary to kind of like translate for me. I think you're 100% right. I think what we're talking about when we say a just transition is really shifting our mindset to thinking much more holistically, right? And there needs to be assessment at every point. And when things are not working, how do we pivot? But how do we also pivot together? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I mean about like these adaptive systems and unlocking change is that you need to bring the right combination of stakeholders to the table. And so for me, as someone who does workforce, I hold some pieces of the puzzle, but I know that I need members of our labor union. I know I need members of the employers themselves that need these workers. I need community-based organizations, but I also need the workers, right? And not every worker is like another. And in the Just Transition, and in this CLCPA, what we are talking about are actually transitioning current workforce either to a different economy or retiring them in a dignified way. That is a very different assessment, and that needs its own assessment sort of tools versus onboarding the new workforce that needs to be part of this renewable energy transition, and it's economy wide. So it's quite dynamic of a system that you're trying to set. So none of this is linear, right? So that's like the clock approach is very linear. I'm talking about a cloud approach, and that these two things need to, systems need to work together in order to affect the kind of change. So I'll give you a very quick, sorry, Eddie, I'm going to give a very quick story so I can really make sure this is translating, is that right now, we know that we do not have the current workforce to implement the CLCPA. We have certain agencies that are affiliated with academic institutions that can certify a lot of, in particular, disadvantaged workers. The problem is there's huge barriers to that. Only a few of the workers that are considered disadvantaged are able to access those trainings. Right. Then you've got, but organizations like mine, we've got wraparound services, other kinds of things that give you that scaffolding that is needed, right? Yep. And then when we talk to contractors, they then tell, you know, our curriculum designs have to be with the workers themselves, the contractors and what they need. We need to be working in partnership and unlocking. Also, the other thing is I don't want to certify 100 workers, say for, I don't know, heat pump or air source pump installation, when only 20 workers are needed. I may need to just like train 30 of them, knowing there's going to be some attrition so that the worker, you know what I mean? So it's like, and then when we talk about community benefits and labor standards and all that, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So,
yeah, no, that's
perfect. I hope you got it. So yeah, it's multi-layered.
And just so you know, we do a lot of this at the DOL now, and I apologize. We tend to be a little bit inside the beltway and don't make it as, you know, specific in the way we talk about it. But yes, you know, especially like with retirees and all that kind of stuff. That is absolutely part of what we do on a regular basis. And going forward, I take your comments very seriously because clearly that's, I mean, to your issue about not training 100 people for 20 jobs, that would be the worst thing we could do. And, you know, the worst thing you can do is train somebody for a job that doesn't exist or that somebody else gets before they get out of their certification. So the long view is, and that's why we're waiting on the job study to reveal more of what really is out there, is to understand it's triage. You know, who needs a job right now? Who has a little bit of a ramp so they can take a year or two of training and that job will be ready for them when they get there? And then how do you prepare young people for a job that's you know, that they're going to grow into? And so it's a lot of balls in the air, but it's very much to what you're talking about. But I appreciate your comment. Thank you very much.
Great. Yeah. Sarah,
yeah, if I could,
you can keep us on. Go ahead,
Dory. Yeah. Sorry, if I could just jump in with one thing, and then I imagine Kevin may have a little bit on EIT as well. But I think, you know, Rawa, listen, I'm glad we had that discussion. I would also say, couldn't agree more with respect to the need for the evolution of these programs to include at least what we call wraparound services as well, knowing that there's facilitative investments that we can make, things like transportation, childcare, counseling, et cetera, that are so necessary to really realize the change that we need. So I would say, at least specific to the programs I know we've talked about, it has become part of the core of the programs that we're running for those reasons as well. And also, really, we couldn't agree more as to the need to plan holistically, not only for the workers themselves, but also for the future of these facilities. The facilities themselves need to become the hubs for these clean energy technologies that we're advancing together. But I appreciate the feedback, and I really do look to the job study to help to address some of the questions that remain that you've rightly brought up. Kevin, did you have anything on the EIT front?
Sure, thanks, President. And just very briefly, thank you for the feedback. And one of the comments about the high heat industrial temperature processes, I had a follow-up question about, because I think that's the panel's perspective, which I think the study, it sounds like, also supports, is that the really high heat processes are difficult to replace just with electricity. And I'd be interested in hearing the Climate Justice Working Group's feedback, if it had a position on, for the balance of those high heat processes that may be trickier to replace with electricity? Are there preferred technological approaches, you know, such as, you know, maybe one of those limited uses of green hydrogen subject to the concerns that you've raised, or are there other technology or process solutions that you would recommend?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, so green hydrogen, we do understand that there may be a limited application for green hydrogen. And again, just with, you know, really assessing projects on a one-on-one individual basis, to make sure it does meet, you know, the requirements of not providing undue burden, pollution burden in environmental justice community. And certainly just making that distinction between green hydrogen, blue hydrogen, gray hydrogen, and being careful about what is prioritized there. Yes, and as Eddie says there in the chat, green hydrogen for fuel cells, yes. For power plants, no. So the mixing of hydrogen and natural gas for combustion purposes is particularly concerning from an air pollution standpoint. So that was definitely a message we wanted to get across. And I'll just ask if any of my other fellow climate justice working group members want to weigh in.
Well, I'll certainly say folks should look at the chat. Elizabeth has written a couple of notes there on a precautionary principle. Paul has also written a note about carbon capture. So if everyone can make sure as this proceeds to capture that, there are also a couple hands raised, Bob, Raya, and Dennis. You folks want to weigh in that order? I didn't know which order they came in, but you want to take it, Bob?
Sure, yeah. Thank you for the opportunity. I very much appreciate the feedback we've gotten from all of the panelists this morning. And Abby, thank you for your kind words about my research. I just want to say I completely agree with the points that you have made. And I see if we have hydrogen in our energy future at all in the state, it should be the most limited role possible. It should be green hydrogen from electrolysis of 100% renewable electricity. But we should recognize that that is inherently an inefficient process. So, for instance, in terms of heating a home, if you're to take green hydrogen and put it into a traditional burner in a home, as opposed to using the renewable electricity directly with the heat pump is 20-fold more efficient. So we really got to make sure we're not using hydrogen in any sort of thought for heating. In terms of the high heat industry needs, the issue came up, Kevin raised it. You know, the technologies are changing rapidly. So up until a year or so ago, people said you need to have high hydrogen or other high heat generating fuels to produce steel. There's now an operating plant in Sweden that is using mostly electricity, renewable electricity, to make most of the steel. All of the heating is coming from electricity. They're using a tiny bit of hydrogen just as a chemical reactant in it, but they're using about 2% of the amount of hydrogen that they would have been using for the heating. So the technologies are changing rapidly, and I would encourage us to pay attention to that changing world in which we live and you know, again, do everything we can to make sure we minimize the use of all hydrogen. Thank you.
Bob, thanks. Raya?
Thank you so much for that. I just wanted to chime. Thank you so much, Bob and Climate Justice Working Group, for, I think, really clarifying, you know, how the lens that we should look at hydrogen through. And I just really encourage this group and for the plan to truly adopt to adopt that lens when it comes to hydrogen. I wanted to uplift, which was said in the chat by Paul, about carbon capture as well. I also wanted to thank you, Rawa, so much for sort of helping us all, and also Elizabeth in the chat, sort of clarifying and helping us understand the value in increased collaboration and transformation of, you know, this workforce development processes and relationship with state agencies. Thank you, Commissioner Reardon. It sounds like folks are open to that continued collaboration and evolution of how we do that work. I'll also say thank you so much, Abigail, for really clarifying and really quoting directly from the CLCPA when talking about the requirements for offsets. That is something that we should be following absolutely to the letter. And I also wanted to ask, one thing I know that, you know, we've grappled with is, you know, how can we have these EJ guardrails as described in the CLCPA, these sort of do no harm, no disproportionate burden to disadvantaged communities. And so I was very glad to hear Elizabeth raise the precautionary principle. And I hope perhaps Elizabeth and others could speak to that a bit and how we can and should apply that principle and others to really harden these environmental justice guardrails.
Do you want me to respond? Sorry, please. I wasn't prepared to talk today. I was here to listen, but I'll be happy to just briefly say that, you know, when the environmental justice movement came together over 25 years ago, one of the things that was central to decision-making when we were talking about a just transition is that we knew that some of the outcomes would be green. They would be green solutions. They would address carbon. They wouldn't address co-pollutants, and that some of the processes would be toxic and would expose workers to another kind of industry that was harmful. And so the goal and the idea that the scientists and the environmental justice movement had is that from soup to nuts, from beginning to end, the process has to be one that builds, that enhances, that honors health, particularly of communities that have a legacy of toxic exposure. And so one of the reasons I put the precautionary principle in there is because we've done so much work and sometimes we forget it and we don't use it. And if you have the precautionary principle centered, just like racial justice and equity, we will be able to come up with recommendations for the state of New York that are transformative, not just for New York, but literally will be looked at from through the rest of the world. So I can't say much more about that, except that I would ask and urge you to look closely at all the work that has already been done about how we do this. I know that it's hard. Workforce development has always been very conventional, and we're asking for something that is radically different, right? But I think that we have an opportunity right here to pause for a second and ask ourselves, is this process, is this policy, is this regulation, is this path, does this do harm? And what do we do to prevent that? Because harm is here. So anyway, thank you. I hope that I was on point. I'm not very focused today.
Thank you very much. It's very helpful.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Dennis?
Yeah, thanks, Basil. Just real brief. I think we got to kind of take a step back. You know, I think workforce development is the new buzzword of the day that I'm a little concerned with, to be honest with you. I think in this particular effort, we've got to kind of like tie a future workforce development to how we define benefits when we look at the climate action or the Climate Act. 40% of the spend is to benefit. So it'll start with benefits. So what is benefit? And then what are those type of worker activities that would actually be able to deliver upon the benefit? It'll also be tied to the recommendations that will be coming out of the Climate Action Council within the framework of the scoping document. So I'd also like to ask that we consider the efficiency and the sustainability of workforce development and really start exploring how we coordinate, consolidate, how do we all work together within the framework of a community on training and wraparound services. To be honest, there's a number that are being created, and I think we got to think about efficiency and sustainability, not just from an environmental point of view, but everything that we do. I think that's kind of like the excitement, because right now most workforce is actually out of state and that are attracted by the subsidies that we're providing, and we got to kind of like rethink that model. The question I had is, and I got a little confused in Abigail when you mentioned something about the focus on ED or too much focus on economic development, but I didn't want to misstate that. I was just kind of confused that maybe I just misunderstood what you said.
Thanks for the question, Dennis. You know, I think as when I was actually, you know, digging into the recommendations, I admit I was surprised how little there was about emissions and about renewables and about electrification specifically. So I just want to make sure, you know, we keep our sights set on the purpose, the overarching purpose, right? To address climate change, to advance climate justice. And yes, you know, the co-benefits that can be realized from that, we absolutely want in terms of economic development, that should and must be part of this, but that can't be our sole reason for moving forward with this work. So just, you know, again, kind of keeping our sights set on the purpose of the CLCPA and making sure that that is the priority, which will at times require, you know, regulation, which might be, you know, tough and politically challenging. But we need to be able to make those hard decisions.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. It just threw me off because there's actually no workforce development without economic activity. So I just want to make sure that we're not kind of like, you know, thinking that these are mutually exclusive. So thanks for that. Thanks, Basil.
Anytime I can be confused with a spice, I'll take it, my man. Peter.
Thanks, Basil. good morning, everybody. I'm hopeful that the participants that are not part of the council are able to see the chat. I think that's the case, but I hope that is the case, and you've been following along with the rich discussion that's been happening there as the presentations have gone forward. I want to uplift one comment that Paul Shepson has made there and wholly endorse it, as well as the comments of Raya and Bob Howarth as well. But I totally endorse what Paul Shepson is saying there about carbon capture and storage not being clean. Abigail laid that out extremely well for us. And I too think the CAC should be resolute and consistent, you know, that we have to, you know, usher towards decarbonization and full electrification across all sectors as fast as we possibly can. One thing that has rung true for me over the last five meetings, I guess now, including this one with the Climate Justice Working Group presenting to us and sharing their perspectives, which has been just tremendous, is this whole concept of 40% of clean energy funds going to the benefit of disadvantaged communities. Gosh, I got to be honest, I hope we can do better than just to the benefit. We should be spending 40% of clean energy funds in disadvantaged communities. We all know that these frontline communities that are largely inhabited by Black and Brown people are at the front lines of the crisis. And merely to suggest that the benefits accrue to that isn't good enough, I think. I think we really should spend 40% of the funds in those communities rather than just get tied up in what benefits are and not benefits. And I think the law allows us that latitude. So I just wanted to make that point. Thanks.
Peter, thanks. Bob and Raya, your hands are still up. I don't know if that's wayward at this point. Donna, I believe, has her hand up, and that should do it before we get back to Eddie.
Yes, thanks, Basil. Appreciate it. Just one comment I would add, and I know we've talked about it before. When it comes to the technologies and considering studies, I just encourage the council. I mean, we're hearing viewpoints on some studies, but not all studies. So I just encourage the council to include an expansive view of studies on things like hydrogen, things like RNG. Clearly, these are things being used elsewhere throughout the country and in Europe to reduce emissions. So just asking that we consider this broad kind of expansive view and be inclusive as we look at the best way to accomplish the goals of the act. So thank you.
Donna, thank you. I now see Anne has her hand raised. Anne?
I do, thank you. I just felt the need to respond to something Dennis said, and I'm hoping I misunderstood what he was saying, but he said most of the workforce is out of state when you talk about the subsidies we're providing. And I want to disagree with that. I mean, one of the nice things about building retrofits for energy efficiency, the enormous amount of retrofitting that's going to happen across the state, and as well as installing renewables, solar, wind turbine construction projects, offshore wind, port development. One of the reasons we love it is those jobs will be in New York State. And so we are going to need the workforce here. If there's any place, you know, where we might need some help, it's the supply chain. And that's why one of my favorite Climate Week announcements was the location of a solar manufacturing facility in the Binghamton area to bring that supply chain here. But I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that we're working for climate action and emissions reductions, but we're also working for having those jobs in New York and making sure the people that get them are both displaced fossil fuel workers or folks from disadvantaged communities, and bring some diversity to that workforce too. And we're not gonna acquiesce, I guess, to an out-of-state workforce for all this important work.
And just to clarify, Ann, your key phrase there is will be. They aren't here yet, so just to clarify.
Well, the construction jobs installing solar are here, and there's hundreds of people, 14,000 people in New York working in the solar industry right now. So we want to bring more. We want to bring that supply chain, but the folks doing building retrofits, energy efficiency retrofits, solar power construction are doing it right now in New York.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for that. If you could drop your hand. Great. Eddie, thank you for indulging us. I think that was important that we pull aside on those two panels before we get to waste.
Sure. My pleasure. Point of personal privilege before I launch in, I just wanted to congratulate Chair Christian for his installation yesterday. But many of us in the environmental justice community see this as an inspired choice by Governor Hochul. And I dare say that this actually gives a lot of us hope. And I do recognize that the words hope and public service commission are rarely combined. So maybe once, I think I remember hearing somebody say, I hope the whole public service commission would, I forget the rest of it, but congratulations, Rory. Godspeed, brother. Appreciate it. So let me just jump right in before I get into the presentation. I'm not going to read the slides. Y'all can do that for yourselves. I thought it was more important for me to share some of the written feedback that we got from some of our representatives on the working group. I'll follow that with a quick summarization of the actual recommendations, followed by a top five, just to channel a little letterman here. So before you see the first slide, I think that what's important to remember is that the state's intent was for recommendations on waste to be handled by an internal working group made up of industry and other stakeholders. This advisory panel, by the way, was only formed after intervention and complaints by advocates. The waste panel recommendations reflect this context. The panel itself was heavily dominated by industry, resulting in problematic recommendations that reject many environmental justice and waste reducing priorities while favoring false solutions such as incineration, landfilling, and biogas markets. Just to give you an example, nearly 100% of the accepted recommendations submitted from a subgroup that Tōpū Yawale created and chaired, the Local Scale Diversion and Climate Justice subgroup, nearly 100% of those recommendations were altered. Over 50% of the mitigation strategies submitted were omitted. 30% of the enabling strategies were omitted. And 100% of the adaptation strategies were omitted from the final presentation to the Climate Action Council. So a summary of the omitted recommendations, I believe Samir will make available to the council members. But, you know, when you see recommendations actually being deleted, not shared, altered, it's troubling. That's the whole point of these working groups. Anyway, while the state's new greenhouse gas emission accounting now attributes dramatically more emissions to the waste sector, the language of many of this panel's recommendations reflects the lead agency's messaging to that panel that recommendations that would reduce methane emissions from landfills would be preferenced, which coincided with the agency allocating far less consideration to recommendations that reduce the excess material production and transportation to begin with. Recommendations ultimately selected by DEC failed to include many recommendations by non-industry advocates. Panelists, including decommissioning New York State incinerators, refusing to renew or even revisit waste export contracts, rejecting incineration-based quote, waste-to-energy proposals like pyrolysis and gasification, or improved air monitoring at incinerators in environmental justice communities. Importantly, an extended producer responsibility proposal was included. Such programs must be shaped by independent parties and do not in and of themselves reduce waste or greenhouse gas emissions, but instead would legislate a funding mechanism with the intent that the producer will take some financial responsibility for waste that will still be generated. Such programs should not originate from industry representatives in the advisory or decision-making processes, but allow community members or independent researchers to have some governance. The lead agency did include some waste reduction strategy recommendations submitted by members of the panel, including a commitment to an eventual phase out of organics from landfills, incinerators, school food waste reduction, and materials and waste planning in stores and restaurants. However, in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve health and economic income outcomes in environmental justice communities, far more emphasis should be placed on waste reduction, materials reuse, composting, zero emissions transportation, and funding circular local scale green jobs and universal organics collection and processing programs within municipalities, and less on false solutions that perpetuate reliance on fossil fuels or waste generation. I'm going to just tack off some of the waste panel recommendations. You all have these, so I don't want to spend too much time on those. Among the recommendations, organic waste reduction recycling, as I just mentioned, again, it's about reducing methane and carbon dioxide emissions by reducing the combustion and landfilling of organics and other GHG-producing waste. Extended producer responsibility, we just spoke about that. Reduce fugitive emissions. Identify and reduce fugitive emissions of methane from landfills and anaerobic digesters through baseline measurement, increased monitoring, et cetera. Recycling markets. Reduce methane and carbon dioxide emissions from those. Biogas use. Recognizing that some waste generation is unavoidable, determine limited and strategic best uses for energy produced from biogas, RNG derived from organic waste. Waste reduction, reuse, and recycling, we covered that. And of course, transformed wastewater treatment plants from waste disposal priority to water resource recovery facilities that emphasize capture of beneficial products. I won't go on. You all have seen the recommendations from the working group. Next slide. The main problem with the composition of the working group, which was tilted to industry and appeared to be less focused on slashing global warming emissions than on advancing industry interest. Also, while the DEC staff was helpful in discouraging the most audacious industry proposals, they decided to submit a long list of possible initiatives, and you heard some of them right now, rather than identify the top five priorities that would provide the biggest climate benefits. So let me rattle some of those top five lists. I don't know if there's a drum roll. Ending the disposal of food scraps and yard waste at landfills and incinerators is probably the single most important action the state can take to cut emissions from the sector. Prohibiting landfill disposal is the first step, since landfills are the third largest source of methane emissions in the nation, according to the EPA. And sending organics to incinerators fouls up the burning process, leads to additional air contaminants, and is inconsistent with the state's environmental justice goals. In contrast, composting of organics produces a useful product that is a natural fertilizer, soil stabilizer, and broadly beneficial to the environment. Legislation to advance these goals should be at the top of the to-do list. Controlling fugitive emissions from landfills, sewage plants, and other methane sources is another critical step. We don't even have precise data on how much of a contribution these sources are. But one document that DEC provided to the group suggested that the emissions contributions from waste sources are larger than originally predicted. It's very important that to get a better handle on the fugitive emissions problem and who the worst offenders are, and then take enforcement action or pass new legislation if necessary to quickly cap those emissions. Third, enacting an extended producer responsibility law will definitely help. So much of the emissions contribution from waste comes from upstream. In other words, the production and manufacture of products and packaging, even before those items reach the consumer, are responsible for plenty of CO2 emissions that are not always included when calculating the climate-altering impacts of the waste sector. One way to reduce this contribution is to produce less stuff. And EPR legislation properly drafted and implemented can provide manufacturers with financial incentives to reduce the amount of packaging and other stuff they generate in the first place. Passing a strong EPR bill in 2022 should be a priority for CLCPA implementation in the waste area. Fourth, advancing domestic recycling. Effective recycling programs can cut the need for virgin materials and reduce emissions in the manufacturing process of consumer goods. Ensuring that there are convenient recycling collection programs throughout the state and that these programs receive adequate funding is a sound objective and another benefit of EPR legislation. Fifth and final, a final idea is to make New York the leading state in the nation for food rescue. The idea is simple. Edible food that doesn't become waste in the first place can generate methane emissions at the end of the line. And this strategy has the added benefit of getting edible food to New Yorkers in need. DEC will say they have just begun to implement a state law that gets this process rolling. But the current state law is just the first baby step in the right direction. As we look to the future, New York should have a much stronger program to require food generators, farms, supermarkets, restaurants, and institutions like universities, hospitals, and probably climate action councils, all develop sophisticated programs that transfer excess edible foods to local food banks and other programs designed to feed the hungry. And one final note of caution, the list of recommendations mentioned the use of biogas and anaerobic digesters. Such facilities may have a role to play in a more environmentally sound waste disposal system, but we need to be careful to ensure that biogas and anaerobic digestion do not intentionally or inadvertently lead to the extended use of fossil fuels. Specifically, a condition for moving forward with or incentivizing the use of anaerobic digestion should be that to the greatest degree possible, the energy generated from such facilities should be used on site, such as providing power to the wastewater treatment plant that's home to digesters, for example. We don't want the use of anaerobic digestion to lead to the construction of big new pipelines that could be a part of the fossil fuel distribution infrastructure. And that's all we have in terms of overall comments. Thank you.
Eddie, thank you. A lot of really good stuff in there. I want to make sure, I don't see all the slides right now. I want to make sure that everything you just said is captured either in the slides or in any comments you gave to us in writing. You mentioned also some of the things that the ideas that were taken off the table were and are no longer in the recommendations. You have those, and I certainly invite you to elevate those to all of us. But thank you for the really important feedback. Want to kick it over to the rest of the team here. I'm sure have questions, reactions. I will note Jared obviously is on, Dave Vitale and Sally Rowland from my office can help to feel any questions. They may have some reactions as well, but I think you have you know the right team on to at least begin the dialogue on this. Raya and Ann, unless Ann is from the old round. Ann, are you still on? Give Raya a chance to lead off.
Yeah, Raya can lead, but that's a new hand.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Eddie. Thank you, Basil, for addressing right off this issue of recommendations that may be missing or deleted. I welcome clarification on what recommendations have made it into the integration analysis and which ones have not, and how perhaps that can be rectified, or at least ask for real transparency there. There was a lot that was presented here. I guess my question is what can the process be, to resolve these, what I'm hearing is unbelievable, real fundamental differences and problems that have been raised. So that was my first question is, what can be the process for resolution of this, immediately in the integration analysis and going forward? And second, it's almost just a comment that I think that just about any person who ever woke up in the morning caring about the environment, you know, as a child, you know, thinks about, you know, this need to focus on waste reduction and diversion and food rescue as being just even bare minimum of what we should be focusing on. And so it's, you know, if there could be some clarification on how it could be that is not sort of front and center, but that's just almost a comment, also a question, but the first piece of how can we get to a place where this divide can be closed in our plan in the near term?
Thank you, Raya and Basil. All important points. And what's actually ironic about this whole thing is that as you heard from some of the feedback impressions I gave from people who actually participated on that panel, you'll see the final bullet on this slide is, as revealed by the integration analysis, greater ambition in reducing emissions from waste is necessary. So had those recommendations been included as part of the waste panel, it would have been incorporated earlier however the Climate Action Council is deliberating recommendations. So it's again ironic that the stuff that was missing from the recommendations, later on the integration analysis says, hey, you know what, some of those things that you guys missed, we need them now. So I will say, in terms of how you find those, Samir, thankfully Samir can share with the council both the actual text, I think, of the the testimony of one of Toko Oyewole, who at the time was working for the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance, testified at the assembly hearing on CLCPA implementation this spring, and in great detail in her testimony laid out which recommendations were missing. So her testimony plus some of the information that Samir can compile with you all will be made available. And, you know, frankly, what you guys do with it is what the council, it's on the council, right? Like, you know, we're now hopefully sharing missing, deleted, omitted, whatever recommendations. But you know, the recommendations are only as good as this Climate Action Council's action. So we look forward to seeing what the council does with these recommendations.
Good. Thank you, Eddie. And honestly, this is exactly why we need your eyes and on all these panels, right? It's to flag the gaps. We bring in a set of recommendations that we all look at, and we need to know where we are short, where we need to make modifications. So all this feedback, is every panel you all have given us feedback on, is all vital. So I'll encourage you and my staff to dig deep into some of the findings we've made on this, and in quick order, so that we can work with the NYSERDA team to do the integration analysis and see where we might be falling short. So thank you. I don't see any other hands up. I do actually, Gavin, and just Gavin at this point.
Thanks, Commissioner. Eddie, you threw a lot at me this morning. I'd appreciate your input as always through this process. I spent, you know, 10 years of my career working at DEC, and I've always found them to be above board, and I was honored to work there. So I do take exception with, you know, how you portray DEC and what they did with these recommendations. So I think they worked hard. As we all know, this stuff is complicated, and there's a lot of implications with it. You know, one of the things that didn't get mentioned today is the avoidance of truck traffic. You know, in Long Island, there's 4 waste energy facilities, and 160,000 plus trucks are avoided on air pollution issues annually. I think that is an important fact that's been left out this morning. Waste energy is recognized under state law as a renewable resource. I know folks may not like that, but that is the law of the state of New York. And where I do agree with Eddie tremendously, I think, is we have to reduce organics in landfills. I don't know how you get to that exactly, but if we're really serious about trying to accomplish some of these goals, reducing organics in landfills is way to go. And I look at, for example, Onondaga County has one of the highest recycling rates in the state of New York, and they have a waste energy facility. So I don't think all industry is bad. I think we work hard to clean the environment, and I think the waste energy facilities provide a useful tool to reduce that organic pollution that Eddie talked about. So I look forward to the integration analysis and how that'll be packaged up by DEC and NYSERDA. But I do appreciate what Eddie laid out here. I have some issues with some of the facts, that's all. Thank you.
Can I do a quick response?
Absolutely.
Yep. So a couple of quick responses. First of all, Gavin, I appreciate your appreciation of it. I would urge you all, don't shoot the messenger. I wasn't on that working. I'm passing along the observations of people who did actually work in that working group for months. And in fact, what is omitted and missing is in writing. So like, nobody's making stuff up. Look at what was submitted and look at what was left out. And there's a written record of this stuff. So, you know, I mean, you can, I don't think anyone was giving or sharing what the motivations were, but it's incontrovertible that there were recommendations that weren't passed along. So, you know, I mean, I can't say anything more about that. In terms of truck traffic, you know, maybe we should have said the words truck traffic, but, you know, well over half of these recommendations would clearly have a reduction in truck traffic in terms of limiting waste export, in terms of, you know, just the amount of waste that gets moved from place to place. And it's like, you know, all of this has some impact on truck traffic. So I agree with you, Gavin. I think the truck traffic needs to be addressed. And I think a lot of these recommendations do just that. And finally, in terms of waste to energy, I would have to ask, my memory's a little vague on this. I didn't think incineration was considered a renewable energy source under state law. If I'm incorrect about that, I stand corrected, but I didn't think incineration was considered a renewable energy source, but I'll defer to others who are expert in that.
It is a renewable resource under state law and the energy law. It's been that way for years. So,
yeah,
maybe Jared wants to pipe in here, but you know, that's a fact.
Yeah, so I think what Eddie's probably referring to is the CLCPA definition for purposes of the 70% renewable energy requirement by 2030. But which I don't know specifically, but I assume that's what you're referring to.
That's a law now too.
Yeah, there's two statements being made, and both are true. The energy law definition of renewable energy includes waste, but the PSC rules and the CES program does not include waste as renewable.
If Doreen, thank you there. If I could jump in with one sort of question for Eddie and a point. You know, this was a advisory panel that had some pretty vigorous disputes among the members, and you know, I think what you see coming out of the panel are the recommendations that had, you know, sufficient support among a group of members from the panel. And absolutely, there were, you know, views expressed by, you know, one of the EJ representatives on the panel and others that maybe were not endorsed by the full group. I believe those are reflected in the recommendations package that came up from the advisory panel, just not as sort of majority recommendations. But if that's not the case, you know, absolutely we're interested in what those list of additional ideas are. This is almost like a good transition to, you know, the Carl talking about the integration analysis, because, you know, we're going to see sort of the level of ambition that is needed across the board, sort of on, you know, along the lines of your last bullet here. So, you know, I think unless there's any other questions, I think that's probably a good place to go right now. But I don't know, Eddie, had you looked at those sort of that listing of the sort of other views that were not, you know, sort of the consensus views? Is that complete or?
No, I haven't, Jared. I'm still trying to catch up with last week's emails. You know what I'm saying? So no.
Okay, I hear you. Okay. Basil, over to you.
I think we have one more hand here. Peter.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to weigh in on this whole issue of waste to energy being considered renewable electricity and the outdated sort of provisions in energy law that I think were set aside when the Pataki administration, you know, rightfully set a renewable portfolio standard that excluded that as an eligible thing. We've seen DEC regulations and more recently the CLCPA that sort of, you know, doesn't recognize, you know, the burning of garbage as a renewable resource is sort of where the modern sort of take on garbage burning fits into our scale. And I also want to sort of add that, you know, we've heard from some of the panel members, both pro-incineration and those who are against incineration, that were part of that waste advisory panel. And we chatted with them about the whole this definition of zero emissions after 2040. And both sides sort of reported to us that that was not part of the discussions as part of the waste panel. They were kind of shocked to sort of see that language when it was presented to them. So, I mean, I think we really need to be moving on, away from combustion. You know, like I said earlier with Paul Shepson's comment on CCS, you know, the vision that this law has, the need for it to be based more in the equity and justice provisions really just says that, you know, this council should be not, you know, trying to squeeze in some areas of trying to burn stuff. We need to move away from combustion and full electrification of our systems as fast as possible. I know I'm a broken record this morning, but we're getting down to the point where we're going to have to start to see the pre-draft plan. And I really think that that should be our commitment and goal and focus.
Great, Peter, thank you. Okay, anybody else have reactions to waste or any of the other panels? If not, I'm not sure if we're on time here.
We are very pleased to report.
Okay. Of course we are. Climate Justice Working Group don't mess around.
Never. Thank you, Eddie. Thank you all, honestly, for all your hard work and all the panels. We owe you all a great deal of thanks, but also feedback and incorporating some of your ideas into all this moving forward. And to Peter's point, time is short. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. I will join in saying that I know this was a lot of work to produce, and I want you to know how seriously we're all taking the feedback. And you'll hear even some of that specifically incorporated today in subsequent presentations, notably with respect to the integration analysis that Carl will be describing in a bit. But if we turn to the next slide first, if you recall, back when we were presented with the land use and local government panel's adaptation and resilience recommendations, there were numerous references to NYSERDA's climate assessment work. And at that time, we committed to provide the council with a briefing of this work. So today, I'm pleased to introduce my colleague, Amanda Stevens, who is a member of NYSERDA's environmental research team, who is leading this important work and here to provide the briefing as promised. So I'll hand it over to Amanda.
Thank you so much. Apologies that you have to listen to me before getting to the integration analysis step, but hopefully this is of interest as well. Next slide, please. And next one. So you can actually step through. I neglected to take out some animations here. So step through maybe four clicks and I'll talk about this. So I think you heard a little bit about the latest IPCC report at your last meeting, but I wanted to set the stage here by sharing a few highlights as well. As this report's over 4,000 pages, I'm not attempting to summarize all of its findings right now, but just a few important points. While previous assessment reports demonstrated that climate change was happening, AR6 emphasizes even more strongly than any previous report that these changes are unequivocally caused by human activities. The global occurrence of extreme events is unprecedented in the observed records, and such events will continue to increase in severity and frequency, threatening vulnerable populations, natural resources, and national economies. Human activities are driving an increase in the emission of all pollutants. In particular, emissions of greenhouse gases are not slowing down. In fact, globally, the rate of emissions was higher in the past decade than at any other time. The goal of the Paris Climate Agreement was to stay below 2 degrees of warming and to make every effort to stay below even 1.5 degrees. But based on multiple lines of evidence and in this new report, global warming of both 1.5 and 2 degrees will likely be exceeded during the 21st century unless deep reductions in CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions occur. Every ton of emissions will have an effect on the climate going forward and will reduce the chances of avoiding catastrophic climate change. And the report further clarifies that not only must the world achieve net zero CO2 emissions, but that the level of emissions must be reduced even farther to avoid many of the worst effects of climate change. Next slide. So before diving into the assessment, I want to talk briefly about our program and how the assessment actually fits in here. So the Environmental Research Program's mission is to increase the understanding and awareness of environmental and public health impacts of energy choices and emerging energy options. So that's pretty broad. It really covers everything from air quality to acid rain, mercury deposition to climate change. We support projects with the intent that those research results will really provide the scientific foundation for policy. Next slide. Just a few examples of some other recent and ongoing climate-related research through our program. Next slide, please. We have just wrapped up on a project looking at the disproportionate heat impacts in New York City and how to keep the most vulnerable cool. And another one just wrapped up on preliminary modeling of building energy use that considers climate change. We're about to wrap on a project modeling how climate could affect renewable resources of wind, sun, and water. And we have an ongoing project taking an early look at how to potentially model migration into and within the state due to climate impacts. So it's kind of a pretty broad range of projects that we look at. Next slide. So getting into the assessment itself, kind of what, why, and how, we'll be providing up-to-date information on impacts and actionable information on adapting to those impacts. This assessment is research driven by our program's mission. So it's not a governmental mandate like the National Climate Assessment or even California's, but it's really mission driven. It's also not an adaptation plan. It doesn't prescribe or dictate policy. It's not a policy or political document, but grounded in science. But similar to the rest of our program, we hope that this work will provide that scientific foundation for good climate policy in New York at all levels of decision making. And our first climate assessment was called ClimeAid, which I'll talk about just in a bit, and it was released almost 10 years ago. So it's time to update it. There's been a lot of new science and information that's been released. And also the IPCC report that I just talked about is at a global scale to sort of really bring it home to people. And here in New York, we need to kind of bring those discussions down closer to the state as well. And we want to do that in part by providing the information in better ways, by incorporating more diverse concerns and perspectives, and also by providing that information in more engaging and useful ways. Next slide. So just a quick look at this versus some other work going on in the state. You all are very familiar with a lot of it. As you know, a lot of what's happening is focused on greenhouse gases and emissions reduction, the causes of climate change. And next, but this assessment will focus instead on how the climate will change. Next slide, please, or next click, anyway. We'll focus on how the climate will change, the impacts of those changes, and how we can adapt or prepare for those impacts. Next slide. So what was ClimeAid? This was really the state's first comprehensive climate change impact assessment. We looked at 7 regions of the state and 8 different sectors, everything from agriculture to energy infrastructure to ecosystems. We downscaled climate projections for those 7 regions, looked at the impacts of those climate changes on those different sectors, and then looked at some adaptation strategies that could be used. As I said, the original report was released in 2011, but we did do an update of the projections in 2014 when the new models came out. Next slide. So similar to ClimeAid, this assessment will be comprehensive, looking at the most up-to-date science and information impacts, but we'll also be kind of building on that, and it's a bit of an evolution over ClimateAid. So the projections and methodologies will, of course, be using the newest models that are out there. We'll be doing a deep dive into the economics. We did a little bit of this in ClimateAid, but we'll be much more in depth in this assessment. And we want decision makers involved in the content development. We think it's important to get a broad range of perspectives on what's important, not just an academic exercise. So we really wanted more diverse perspectives included. And more products and outputs. I'll talk about this a little bit more in the future, but you know, we'll still have a technical foundation document, but it won't be the only output from the assessment. We'll also be moving the ball forward on adaptation strategies. People want to know how they can respond to the impacts we'll be telling them about. So we will likely be including a lot of case studies. We want people to have actionable information to help them make decisions. Next slide. So a little bit on the projections. We've contracted with Columbia University to do those for us. So there will be some continuity with ClimateAid as they did those for us there as well. But they're also working with New York City, and we've got a lot of coordination with the MPCC there as well. The draft, what I call core projections, have already been completed. So that's things like average and extreme temperature, precipitation, those sorts of things. And they'll likely be released later this year. Sea level rise is more complex, and that likely won't be available until the spring, but it is coming. Next slide. We've contracted with IEC to model the economic impacts of climate change on all the different sectors under a couple of different emission scenarios. So they won't be looking at every single aspect of every single sector, because some things just can't be modeled right now. But whatever is possible to be modeled, they will be doing. And as feasible as well, they'll be looking at the modeling the impacts of adaptation strategies as well. So for some things, we'll be able to look at sort of the cost of no action versus the cost of adapting. There aren't a lot of models that do that, but so it won't be, you know, super comprehensive, but we will be doing as much as we can. We have or will have some preliminary results this year, but really most of the modeling work will take quite a while. So that won't be until probably middle of next year. Next slide. So to get through most of the technical work, we have 8 main sectors, and each of those is being covered by a technical work group. Each work group is made up of about 8 to 10 people. And I have to say, I'm excited about the breadth of expertise, experience, and backgrounds that we have on these working groups. We have nearly 80 individuals from more than 60 different organizations, from universities to businesses to state and local government to community focused groups. So it's really exciting to have that group of people actually involved, again, in the content development. We tried to pay attention to diversity in various forms when we were putting these work groups together, including regional, gender, ethnic and racial, career stage. So we really wanted to, again, bring those different perspectives to this work. We do also have the opportunity to expand even those perspectives farther through the sector advisors. So each working group will have their own group of additional folks who can help provide additional input and feedback throughout the process. Next click. We acknowledge that there are a lot of topics that are really cross-sector, but there are 4 in particular that are significant interest right now in the state and to stakeholders, and those are equity and disadvantaged communities, municipal perspectives, marine coastal zones, and Great Lakes area. And rather than having separate work groups for those, we really wanted these topics to be integrated in every work group. So we've embedded these perspectives into each of the work groups. In putting together the TWIGs, we endeavored to make sure that there was at least one person with experience and expertise in each of these topics on every group, so that those topics will hopefully be integrated pretty well into the sectors. Next. So getting to the outputs and products, as you see, we structured the working groups in a way that is hopefully efficient for the development of the technical content, but it does not and will not constrain the outputs. We want products that meet a wide range of users' needs, not just a giant technical report. So while we will still have that technical foundational document, it will be packaged into multiple outputs in addition to that. So things like, you know, a statewide summary, multi-sector topical reports like equity, maybe rural communities, regional reports focusing on different regions of the state. And these will all be targeted at different audiences, different needs, and they'll all draw from all of the technical chapters as necessary. So that's where we'll get some of that integration as well, and that kind of cross-sector topical discussion. We will have stakeholder engagement throughout to make sure that the information we produce and present is what's needed to actually make good decisions and not just what we think people need. And to me, these outputs are at least as important as the content itself. Next. Last, I just want to give you a brief timeline. I will say it took a lot longer than anticipated to form the working groups. Getting just the right people involved took time, but I think it was worth it. But we did have the kickoff with the working groups earlier this week, which went really well. I'm very excited about it. And we're now ready to forge ahead. So we expect to have at least the technical information drafted by the end of next year. We don't want to push too much farther than that, but likely some of the outputs and products might take a little bit longer to pull together, but we're aiming to have the technical information by the end of next year. And that's all I've got. Happy to take a few questions.
Thanks. Thanks, Amanda. I'm glad you've described the means by which perhaps some of the CAC members might want to engage. So we'll certainly follow up in that regard. But if anyone has questions, please do raise your hand. Looks like Raya's first up.
Thank you so much. Just a brief overarching question. What a ambitious, exciting, interesting analysis and process that's been brought together here. I was curious in terms of what precedent or what other jurisdictions, you know, have done this type of report. I'm getting the feeling this may be a precedent setting, you know, effort, but I'm interested in sort of how other jurisdictions have looked at this and what precedent you've looked at for what looks like a very, very compelling process.
Yeah, so there are a number of states that have done them. California, obviously, does them on a regular basis. There are states like Indiana that's done them, Washington. They all do them a little bit differently, but we did take a look at all of them to see what we could pull from to see what would, make this the best that we could try to do. But I do think, in my mind, at least going forward from what we did in our climate assessment, I don't want to say we're doing a ton better than everybody else out there, but I am very excited about the opportunity we have to bring different types of people to the table and actually in developing the content, not just giving their input, which is also what we're going to have and what's important, but also they're at the table doing some of the writing and making sure that we are actually getting the information out in ways that they need and the actual information that we need. So I think we're really a step ahead there. I'm very excited about that, and also in the types of products that we have the ability to develop. Last time around we didn't have many resources to do anything other than a technical report, and that's really what is out there in a lot of assessments. But we do have the opportunity to do more here. And I will say, actually, I'll give a shout out to Indiana. Their assessment products are fabulous. So I will be, looking to them and kind of taking some notes on what they did and what we can do as well.
Shout out to Indiana. Well, that's been heard in this process before, but great to hear it. Thanks, Raya. Certainly, we do have learnings that along the way that we've applied, so it's good to hear that that's in place as we move forward. Any other questions? I do not see any other hands raised. All righty. I think that means we can can move to our next topic. Thank you again, Amanda. You. And I know you'll be back to tell us more as this progresses, I'm sure. So if we turn to the next slide, we are going to pivot into the last major agenda item, which is the integration analysis. As we are all well aware, Carl Maas from NYSERDA has presented at the last several meetings. First, some initial outputs from the test runs of the integration analysis and various scenarios designed based on input from the council members. So today, Carl is back and will be presenting some of the initial scenario runs, namely the measure adoption and the resulting GHG emission reductions. So although I've said it before, I'll say it again. While the integration analysis is a critical piece of work that will inform the scoping plan, it is just one of many inputs into the scoping plan. So certainly it's designed to assess the GHG reductions and benefits and costs of the portfolios of measures statewide that we could advance. So the implications of various policy recommendations can be understood. So we'll see the initial scenario results today, and then at our next meeting in just a couple weeks, Carl will be back to present the full scenario results, which will create a bigger picture view for each of you. So without further ado, Carl, I'll hand it to you to take it from here.
Great. Thank you, Doreen. And also just want to thank you, Amanda. I think what she makes clear for us, and she reminds us why we are here, right? What's the imperative that's brought us all to the table, and that we have to do two things at once. We have to mitigate and we have to adapt. And so we'll be looking for those kinds of synergies in the years to come. So maybe before I launch in, it's a pleasure to be back with you all again. I've really enjoyed our dialogues over these months. I want to thank kind of the gigantic staff team who has done a lot of heavy lifting over these months to get us to this point where we can share some of our first comprehensive findings. All the advisory panel members, we have over 100 folks who we worked with over many months, and we've leveraged their thinking and we've expanded from it. Thank the co-chairs who have each personally engaged in this work, and then some of the academic and national lab experts who've been engaged as part of the panels, as well as helping us along these very many years of getting here. And then we had a number of consultants who were contributing to the half dozen various studies. We've had previous slides that have mentioned roadmaps. And other work products on HFCs, methane emissions. You know, there have been consultant teams from all over the country who have been brought forward and have given us a lot of effort. Our kind of focal point consultant team, though, is E3. They've done work for us over the years. They've done work for California, Washington, at the national level. And really, they've done the heavy lifting in these last weeks to really translate those scenarios that we worked so hard to pull together with you all and to turn it into actual numbers for us to try to gauge. As Doreen mentioned, and we really do see this as a starting point for the dialogue of how to realize our limits. This is one of the important inputs and will help to form a foundation for the scoping plan, but it certainly is only one piece of it. So I do have 100 slides here, but don't worry, I'm not going to walk you through each of them in detail. That could be a several day exercise. What I do want to get to is I want to give you all a comprehensive summary of the information we have. I want to give you time between this meeting and next to investigate some of this material. We're going to put this all up on the website. And along with even a deeper dive opportunity with some Excel workbooks. And again, I'll have that web link in a future slide. And then as Doreen mentioned, on October 14th, we're going to come back together. We'll be able to unpack some of the sectoral details, get into some of the sensitivities, and then get at some of the actual benefits and costs. So this focus today is really just to introduce you to what we've found. So I really do want to treat this as a multi-part series. So next slide, please. And another one. Okay, so as I mentioned, this is a deep slide deck. We've got overview and key findings. I'll hope to get through the economy-wide
results that we've seen. The Tektor results are deep and detailed. What we'll probably need to do is save those for next time, but there are specific questions. We can dig into those, as well as we have even more in our backup materials. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, we have our Climate Action website, which will have meeting materials. So obviously this full slide deck will be there. We will extract this deck and put it on our resources page. As I mentioned last time, in this resources page, we've already posted key drivers for the reference case and the test run. So those were the cases I showed you all last time. So we've got some very detailed workbooks for those who want to dig into some of those key drivers that give us these outputs. And again, we will put more workbooks on there in the coming days. Next slide, please. And again, next slide. Okay, so it's always important, I think, to level set on where we are before we talk about where we're going. So this is not new information. We maybe have pulled out one more detail, which I think is helpful. So as I've mentioned before, buildings and transportation are our two largest sources, roughly co-equal. They represent over 50%. Within those, we see that space heating and passenger vehicles are our biggest slices, and we have to focus a lot of attention there. We've also noted, though, that electricity and waste have risen to make up a large section of the pie. Electricity has always been there, but waste has kind of joined the top four group because of our new accounting. So that's over 75% of our emissions. And then some very important aspects and kind of end-use products and industry round out the pie. The other aspect I just wanted to throw up here, which I don't think I presented before, and we have more details in the deck, is what does this look like in terms of gases? CO2 in the past has been over 80% of our carbon footprint. We now see that it is around 60%, and CH4 methane has grown to 35% of our current emissions. So again, it's reemphasizing the importance of those sources. We also see HFCs are around 4%. It may sound like a small number, but as I've shared with you in the reference case, it will grow substantially if we don't mitigate. The good news is we have ideas, and we also see action at the federal level around HFCs. I mean, this is a global issue, which New York needs to be one part of the answer. Next slide, please. Okay, so just a quick walkthrough on the overview of scenarios. This is not new, but slightly reformatted from what I shared with you last time. We've already walked through the reference case, what we're calling our scenario one, which is what came from our advisory panels. We then have developed three additional scenarios, number two, three, four. What's true, and it really came from the findings of the advisory panels and supporting analysis that we've done over years. When you dig into the literature, you see consistently that there are pillars of any decarbonization, whether it be New York, California, Europe, Asia. We need to see zero emission power. In this case, we have it written into law by 2040. We need to see enhanced and expanded transit and VMT reduction. We need to see more rapid and widespread end-use electrification and efficiency. We need to see higher methane mitigation in ag and waste. I think that was brought up during the previous discussion with our colleagues in the Climate Justice Working Group. End-use electric load flexibility is key. We've heard that from our council members. We've seen it in our studies. And that's going to require a number of things, including consumer engagement and new technology. So all of those are baked into our scenarios, and I think in some ways, given that foundation, from one perspective, our scenarios may look very similar. And so what I'll try to emphasize is, again, where we see common threads and where we see some key differentiating factors. So scenario two is our strategic use of low-carbon fuels. And so what does that mean? It means we're including the use of bioenergy derived from biogenic waste, agriculture, forest residues, and limited purpose-grown biomass, as well as green hydrogen. And again, all of that is focused on the hard-to-electrify applications. I can't overemphasize that significant electrification you'll see across all scenarios. And what we're trying to unpack is how do we keep the lights on how do we keep people warm in a way that's going to look at a risk portfolio? And that's why we looked at scenario three, which was how do we go even further? And how do we look at a low to no bioenergy and a limited hydrogen combustion scenario? And I think that reflects what we heard today, again, from the Climate Justice Working Group. And what do we need to do to make that happen? We have to accelerate electrification even faster. And we have to look at, are there non-combustion ways of using hydrogen? And then scenario four rounds out the group. And really what we saw here is that we needed to articulate a vision for going beyond 85%. And largely that's driven by the fact that what we've seen through aggressive stance and really a fresh look at our natural and working lands, it's going to be a challenge to see 15% net sequestration going into our lands. And so in order to go above that roughly 40 million metric tons of what we think can go into our land, we would need to look at new technologies for air capture, which I'll get into later. Obviously, these are uncertain. And so what we wanted to do is draw in a scenario that went further. So hopefully there's nothing new in what I said. It's just a quick recap of where we're going for the next hour. Next slide, please. So this is a lot to take in, but what we wanted to do is come up with a qualitative dashboard. And you'll see that these themes will continue throughout the 100-slide deck. And so we wanted to use in this way is to highlight some of the things that are common. And you'll see there's a lot of commonality. And what are some of the key differentiating factors? And so, for example, energy efficiency, transit, zero-emission vehicles. There is no modest approach to any of these three pillars. We have to have high levels of ambition across all scenarios. What we've seen, though, in scenario three and four is that we have to go even further in order to accelerate those transitions, in order to have a balance against some of the other resources that we won't be drawing on. So in scenario three, it balances out the fact that we aren't going to deploy as much low-carbon fuel. In scenario four, we just have to go further. So the key differentiating factor that I want to bring forward here is around low-carbon fuels. We have three different levels here to really help us explore and understand what low carbon fuel levels might look like. Just to be clear, this is an indicator of the level of transformation. We do not see that there's going to be a large quantity of low carbon fuels. Again, electrification will be the core, but we are looking at different levels and dials there. When we look at mitigating emissions from ag and waste, we've had to be more aggressive across all scenarios. And we even turn up the dial further in order to go beyond 85%. And then again, I think the other, like low carbon fuels, one of the key differentiating factors are these negative emission technologies, where we see that we do need to use them in our first two scenarios, two and three. And what scenario four do is pressure test, what if those technologies don't emerge, what do we need to do? Next slide. Okay, so some key findings. You know, what I want to serve up here are some of the key takeaways right up front, and then I'll unpack them in roughly 20 slides, maybe a little bit more. So, you know, I think we've recognized that the achievement of our reductions really requires action across all sectors, and that just was made even more clear when we considered our new accounting practice. There is no sector that can be left behind. Everyone must transform. They'll transform at different rates and we'll have different answers, but we do need kind of an all of economy, you know, all components of the economy, private sector, public sector getting engaged. In terms of energy efficiency and electrification, so they are essential parts of every pathway. And what I've unpacked here are just some of the milestones that we're drawing from some of our analysis. So in all scenarios modeled, zero emission vehicles and heat pumps, so that's the core for getting the carbon out of our transportation and our buildings. If you recall from that first slide, the biggest slice of the biggest wedges are light duty vehicles and building heating. That comes a majority. What we see is that they become the majority, these heat pumps and electric vehicles, of new purchases by the late 2020s. So that's in this decade. and that fossil emitting cars and appliances are no longer sold after 2035. So what does that mean, some numbers? What we're seeing across our scenarios is between 1 to 2 million efficient homes that are electrified with heat pumps by 2030. And we see that approximately 3 million zero emission vehicles, which will be in our modeling showing us mostly battery electric by 2030. So these are really transformative numbers. You know, we have thousands of vehicles on the road. You know, we have seen over this recent years around 100,000 electric vehicles have come into the road. So we're talking about stepping that up orders of magnitude for both of these areas. This is unprecedented rate of adoption for novel and potentially disruptive technologies. And disruption, I think, is neither positive nor negative. We're seeing new opportunities, new functionalities in these systems. We're able to get emissions out of your indoor airspace. I think drivers of electric vehicles are seeing new options and functionality that they hadn't yet realized were possible. We also want to recognize that with this disruption comes change. And that really means that the consumer decision-making will have to play a large role. We are pivoting from thinking about how to transform our supply to thinking about how we continue the arc of our supply transformation and bringing it to everyone's lives. And think about how do we empower consumers to make those choices now so that we can get on to this further bending of the curve. We're also seeing that there's a substantial reduction in vehicle miles of travel and increasing transportation access. So that's about expansion of transit services in a way that meets communities where they are. It's about smart growth and inclusive and equitable TOD, and also about how we better manage our transportation system. Next slide. So as I think I've said before, but it's worth repeating, the wind, water, and sunlight are gonna power the majority of New York's economy. As we electrify, it will mean not just your lights, but your cars and your home heating systems. Even with aggressively managed load, and we have looked deep at wide and how to further animate buildings to make buildings part of the answer, how to think about how to shift this new growing vehicle fleet that will be drawing electricity from the grid in a way that's smart. But even with those very aggressive, we see that at least a doubling of our overall electric needs is going to occur, which is also matched by nearly doubling of our peak needs by 2050. We also become winter peaking in 2035, which is similar to what we've seen in the past, maybe a little bit faster than we saw last summer. So just to give you a snapshot, and I'll unpack it further, you know, in terms of what we're seeing for the grid for this clean supply out to 2050, we see on the order of 20 gigawatts of offshore wind. So that would be a doubling of our current near-term goal. We see on the order of 60 gigawatts of solar. Really, we're seeing that the 10 gigawatts that the governor just announced of distributed solar, coupled with the likely 10 gigawatts that we'll see of large scale, is the correct down payment and the correct path to get towards this long-term vision in 2050. We also see that we're going to need substantial amounts of short-duration storage on the order of 20 gigawatts out by 2050. And that is necessary to complement these intermittent resources, but that's not enough. And we see there's a substantial need for firm zero-emission resources. Examples are green hydrogen and long-duration storage technology, which will play an important role to ensure that our lights stay on beyond 2040. So pivoting to low-carbon fuels. So low-carbon fuels such as bioenergy and hydrogen play a critical role in helping us to decarbonize those challenging-to-electrify end uses. Just some indicators we're seeing from the work that by 2030, we see the emergence of markets that will adopt green hydrogen. Again, we think there's time for the on-ramping and to build up this new industrial base. And some of the early applications we're seeing are medium and heavy-duty vehicles and some of those high-temperature industrial processes that we all talked about earlier today. We do see additional promising end-use applications into the future. Things like district heating and other non-road transportation like aviation. I do want to honor here Bob Powers' point that he's made several times, which is really a cautionary tale around thermodynamics of hydrogen for heat. And I think we absolutely agree that we have to look at how we use our precious wind, water, and sunlight, and stretch those electrons as far as we can, and really look at what are those limited and very important hard-to-electrify applications. And then we see that we can pull out the arrow out of the quiver that is hydrogen, potentially. And then thinking about our non-CO2, non-methane emissions is our refrigerants, our HFCs. So we have to dig into a transition towards low global warming potential refrigerants and think about how to manage those better out into the future. Next slide. Next slide, please. Hopefully, maybe Doreen, is my volume working?
No, you're good. I see in the bottom corner it says reconnecting. Maybe the slide show is stalled out here.
I will take this lovely opportunity to take a drink.
At least you're not holding a microphone, too, Carl. Come on. It's good.
Yeah.
Anyone on the team can advise as to what we should do, if we should forge on or wait. That would be useful.
Yeah, I can certainly speak to the material.
Sorry about that. I think we are working on the transition.
Thank you.
Right. This transition is not going to be easy. There's one more key finding slide. Maybe what I'll do is I'll just speak to it now to give you a preview, and then we can pull it up once it comes back. So just the kind of third set of key takeaways, focus on, first of all, our sequestration. So I already spoke about some of the kind of opportunities that we have to think about working lands. We see that a large-scale carbon sequestration in our land and forests and negative emission technologies are going to be needed. So what does that mean, or what are the implications? We have to protect and grow our New York forests in order to really have any hope of hitting our carbon neutral goal. We do see that negative emission technologies like direct air capture may be required if we can't exceed 85%. I think we're on slide 40, if you can jump there. And then the third kind of part of the dialogue around sequestration is that we have to think about our strategic land use planning and think about these kind of dual imperatives that we have to share the land with our existing uses. We have to think about how to grow that sequestration in our natural working lands over time. We're also going to need more land for those 60 gigawatts of solar. And so this is something we'll unpack a little bit more next time, but there's absolutely an imperative going forward of thinking how to strategically use land. As was mentioned earlier, we see that it's necessary to mitigate further methane emissions from both waste and agriculture. It's really looking for transformative solutions in this space. So we have to do a diversion of organic waste. We have to look at how we can better capture fugitive methane emissions. We have to look at alternatives in our farming system, so alternatives to manure management, to look at new approaches for animal feeding practices. And as I'll show at the end, you know, our three, and as the last bullet shows, our three largest remaining sources are going to be in 2050, landfills, animal feeding, and aviation. So clearly, you know, even with aggressive approaches to reducing methane, we still see those are going to be dominant sources in the future. And then finally, you know, all of this sets the stage for the innovation agenda. We see innovations are going to be required around carbon sequestration solutions, whether it be, again, looking at soil carbon. We're looking at a significant need for long-duration storage opportunities to help both manage our portfolio risk as we think about going beyond 2040 on the grid. We're going to need new approaches to making load flexible. As I mentioned, we need new low global warming refrigerants. And really, this needs to be done in concert as a region and as a nation. I think we're heartened by recent federal actions we're seeing, the recently announced Earth Shots. There is one for hydrogen. There is one for long-duration storage. It's really about how does New York play a role in helping to advance those national objectives. And, you know, parcel to that is bringing those activities to New York so we can realize those economic benefits of these new industries. Next slide. Okay, so now we're going to go beyond some of the qualitative, and what we have here is each of our scenarios at a glance. I'm not going to read all these slides off to you, but what I would like to do is highlight just a couple of points. So what we saw, you know, from our scenario one, which I walked through before, this really helps us to see how we can foundationally bend the curve. And we know it didn't quite go far enough. But what we do see is a ramp up, even in our scenario one, a significant ramp up in building efficiency and heat pumps. You know, through our scenario one, out to 2030, we see 1 million homes. We do see that we have a culmination of both zero emission vehicle sales and heat pumps by 2035 and beyond as being 100% sales rates. You know, by mid-century, we see additional major actions and innovations across waste, agriculture, and industry. And in this scenario, we see low carbon fuels play a key role as early as 2030 and out to 2050. So just to orient you to how the slides will progress, I'm going to go through each scenario. What we try to do is put bold and even change color for some of the key input drivers that have changed in order to meet our goals. So next slide. So scenario two is our strategic use of low carbon fuels. You know, so what we're seeing here is increased zero emission vehicles and heat pump sales before 2030. You know, we've gone to, just as one indicator, 1.5 million homes are electrified with heat pumps. We're also seeing that, you know, we have on the order of 2.7 million zero emission light duty vehicles by 2030. We do see in this scenario an increased use of renewable distillate share in 2030. And we see, again, going further, pushing further on mitigating methane in both waste and agriculture. Next slide, please. So scenario three is, again, an accelerated transition away from combustion. So what does that mean? You'll see in red some of the key indicators. So in 2030, we've increased the ambition further to 1.8 million homes that are electrified and are paired with building shell improvements. We see 3.4 million zero emission vehicles that are on the road and greater electrification industry. And, you know, some of these numbers can be a little bit abstract, but, you know, the implication of getting this many homes electrified and this many ZEVs on the road is that we're going to have to go beyond natural turnover and really going to have to look at early retirement of old heating systems. And that has implications both in terms of the types of policy interventions, but also in terms of cost. So what we'll be unpacking in our later slides on the 14th is, you know, what do we see are some of the trade-offs there? Next slide, please. And then scenario four is really a combination of some of these threads. We have to do early retirement. We're going to have to lean on some of our zero, our low carbon fuels as well. And then obviously we're going to have to even go deeper into some of our non-CO2. One of the other levers that we've pulled here is being more aggressive around our VMT reductions. So we see a substantial increase in more of the mobility options in this scenario. And, you know, again, we'll need to think through what would be the policy implications of those combination of both changing out vehicles, but also bringing in yet more VMT reduction. So I will go to the next slide. And I think that's a good time to pause because that was, I think, a fair amount to take in. I just want to open it up to some kind of high-level thoughts and discussion before we dive into some of the economy-wide output.
Thanks, all right. Oh, are you going to run this, Sarah?
I'd be happy to.
Great, thanks.
All right, so I see we've got Bob Howarth with a raised hand as well as Ann Reynolds and Rory.
Thank you, great. Sarah. Bob. Thank you, Carl. You covered a lot of information there. And I appreciate you mentioning my continuing concern about use of hydrogen and heating. Very much appreciated. It's clear from what you've said, and it's my sense going into this already, that the sectors we really need to pay attention to are the heating building sector and the transportation sector. And, you know, my worry is we often get sidetracked into the smaller parts of the debate here, getting to the final last 15% and what agriculture can do. All of that's important, but I think it's critical that the council in our remaining few months before we come up with an implementation plan concentrate on those, you know, more than 50% of the emissions that are represented by those two sectors. And from my perspective, we should do whatever we can for transportation, but we're partially hamstrung by whatever the federal government and the state of California want to do. And so I really hope that we focus very, very hard on the building sector. Our challenges for the building sector are much greater than California's. We really can't look for them for leadership here. It's something we have to handle. And so accelerating that transition to me is the key. And focusing on what the mechanisms are, the funding mechanisms which will allow that accelerated change. I hope that'll be a major part of how we spend our time over the next few months. But anyway, I appreciate your summary. It's very clear. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Anne?
Was Anne next?
Yep. That's correct.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. For scenario three there, I think it said, if you could go to that slide, it said limited reuse of captured methane or something like that, and I was wondering if...
Yeah, why don't we go...
Yeah.
So was it on this slide or on the summary slide?
Scenario.
I can speak to it. So, yeah. So what we're thinking there is we need, and I think as I highlighted in a previous discussion, in order to go beyond, what we think we need to do is look at the places where methane is being generated because of some other process. So if it's waste management or in agriculture. And how do we grab that methane and put it to a positive use? And that could be for, again, on-site heating or electric generation. But we think that simply flaring that to destroy the methane misses an opportunity. And in order to realize us going beyond 85%, we're really going to have to try to put every aspect of our system towards our energy services.
Good. Thanks. Got it.
Then I see Rory Christian, Dennis Elsenbeck, and Raya Salter are the next few.
Great. Chair Christian, nice to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I like the presentation of the analysis, and I just want to confirm a few things regarding 100% penetration of bus sales and electric vehicle adoption. The assumption at these points is that all new purchases of those vehicles will be EVs. So not necessarily existing fleets will completely decommission, but that going forward, any additions will be. Okay. Just wanted to confirm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so one of the aspects of the modeling, which we can certainly brief you on, is we have a detailed stock rollover model. So it actually looks at how many of these vehicles and homes and appliances are going to turn over. And so a key focus there is what is the percent of sales? And then it works itself into the economy.
Got it. And when you move from scenario 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, you have the increase in growth of electrification happening throughout through the form of EVs, greater adoption of heat pumps. Do you also have a commensurate increase in availability of renewable energy associated with meeting those needs modeled in? You do. Okay. Just one.
Yes, absolutely. And we do have a couple slides for the next part that will show that. Yeah. But absolutely. So it's an integrated modeling platform, which, you know, means it has to cover every piece of the economy that could have a carbon footprint and the parts that will then feed zero carbon energy into it.
Thank you. And Bob beat me to the building squad comments. So I just want to add that I agree with Bob. We should be emphasizing, and I believe we are, looking very carefully at buildings. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Dennis, you're up next.
Yeah, Carl, as always, great job. Does the increase, so we're looking at the increase of 1 to 2 million heat pumps by 2030. Does that then include looking at the impact on distribution network? I know we always look at it from the point of view of additional renewable energy, but are we looking at it on a forward basis on distribution? And then maybe this is early, but what the impacts then on home energy cost as a result of shifting from, you know, from a fossil to an electric? And relating to that is we always talk about long duration storage. Do you refer to that as supply side long duration or demand side long duration or both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So great questions. So in terms of the long duration storage, our modeling goes down to the zonal level. And so we do believe there will be applications on both sides of the meter, but we're looking at, you know, 100-hour plus systems. So the kind of the prototypes that we've seen tend to have a fairly large physical footprint. If you look at some of the kind of new metal air technologies. So it's more likely to be the case that the long duration will have to be kind of grid scale. But certainly, you know, we are intrigued and interested by that. I will say that the 20 gigawatts of short duration, those 4 to 8 hour batteries, those would be sprinkled throughout the system. They would be customer sited. They would be grid sited. So I think we're going to see a massive ramp up in that market, especially in the back half of this, you know, 30 year arc. And we definitely would want to take advantage of the benefits at the distribution level. And it's not just because it will reduce costs, but there's a resilience aspect there when we can site the storage near load. Yeah. So that was the third question. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Just, Carl, it's just that I'm concerned that we set goals and we did another adjustment on the solar side with going from 6 gigawatts to 10 gigawatts, which is admirable in the way to look at this. But what we do is then follow as a reactionary point of view the need to upgrade infrastructure and transmission. It's almost like your study should almost be pushing for a more prospective view on transmission and distribution planning, mm-hmm. because right now we're playing catch up. You know, our policy created generation pockets that we're now trying to resolve. Your studies are more of a forward view. So, I mean, shouldn't we be looking at it from your point of view, aligning with these type of projections so that we're being ahead of the game? And if it requires different regulatory changes in the way we do the standard interconnection requirements, let's do those now while you're projecting versus the cost mm-hmm. of just passing that on to ratepayers because we didn't pre-plan it. I don't know your thoughts on that, but I know you and I have talked about.
No, absolutely. And our team has looked at marginal cost of service study for the utilities, and they have included both in the infrastructure build-out as well as in the cost and benefits, both the distribution side that has to grow as well as our bulk transmission. And I do think, you know, as we saw in the power grid study in terms of transmission and for the first period of time, it's going to be more looking at the on-ramps to get onto the grid. And then what this study now brings to the table is that distribution side. And to really think about, you know, what's the level of investment that's going to be necessary so we can see that as a comprehensive package. And what was your second question? I think I hit the first and the third.
I think you did. I think you had everything.
I got it. Okay, great.
Yeah, I appreciate that. This
is Raul. I'm sorry. I think, Dennis, you did ask a question about cost to households.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the work that we will be doing, we'll be looking at total societal benefits and costs, the question of who pays actually gets translated as these policies get implemented. You know, so as an example, it would be, you know, if there are certain levels of incentives for certain technologies, kind of how the consumer feels those eventual costs could be shifted. So we will be specifically highlighting by sector, you know, what these net costs will be. And then we can think about as a later stage, as regulations play out, you know, then we'll get into the details of who and how those payments are made. And that's, you know, as an example, when we looked at our clean energy standard, that was the sequence that unfolded.
And you're referring in that regard to monthly bills, correct, Carl? Because that's what I think Rao is.
Well, I heard you speaking more broadly, which I thought was the right question, which was, you know, as a consumer thinking about my wallet, it's a whole picture, right? Is there an added capital cost? What is the O&M cost, including fuel savings, right? So those are the kinds of comprehensive pictures that will need to come over time. Our first cut in 2 weeks will be, again, by sector. How are we seeing these net costs and these net benefits working?
Carl, one last thing, I really appreciate this, is the earlier we were discussing workforce development. This, what you're also painting is the pathways to workforce needs. And you even mentioned that, and I hope this innovation happens in New York, right? I mean, we do too. So how do you see this, and maybe this is too early in the game, but how do you see this transitioning to, let's say, our labor studies? Because I just think this is a great roadmap.
Yeah, no, and that's I didn't plant the question, but I do appreciate it. So the Just Transition Working Group has been given the obligation to build a job study, and it has to be sequenced. So we need to chew on these scenarios, and then we hand it over to the job study team. And then in a month's time, they're going to come back to us with just this answer. You know, what does this evolving workforce look like? What are the needs for new training? But we didn't want to get ahead of this work and the work of the council. We needed to be able to digest and understand these pathways before we then launch them into the jobs analysis.
Raya Salter.
Hello, thank you so much. This is fascinating. I really look forward to digging into it. I've got, and thank you so much, Carl, and I've got really two questions. The first is if you could, for my benefit and perhaps others, revisit and very clearly state the scenario that represents the decommissioning of fossil fuel infrastructure in New York State, and just make very clear where that pathway lies for us. And second, again, as was echoed by earlier comments, continue to be very disappointed at the emphasis on this last mile, this last 15%, when we know we've got so much to do that, you know, our plans are already not ambitious enough, and the initial drops are clearly more important. And so one question that relates to that is, I'm just interested to know, has there even been a risk and codependency analysis here that even justifies this last, 15%, scenario planning? And I think we need to stop this emphasis and focus on, what can be doable in our near term. So those are our two questions.
Right. Yeah, that's great. And so maybe that second one first, in terms of kind of getting to the last mile. I agree we probably spend a disproportionate amount of time on it because of the complexity and uncertainty. I hope in our slides, that we've thoroughly emphasized what the pathways look like and how the steps along the way. There's a lot of commonality. I think there's more commonality in what we need to do to decarbonize and deeply electrify our end uses. And so I think your point is a great one, and certainly one that I think needs to translate into the actual scoping plan itself. Right. What will be the emphasis for the words, and how will we draw attention to some of these key findings? So certainly agree with that. And then just in terms of portfolio management, I think part of the risk assessment for the hard to electrify end uses is one that all of the panels did engage with over time. and gave us their feedback of some of the different levers that they thought could be pulled. And then as we looked at this new accounting system, we saw that some of these levers might have disappeared. You know, I think there were recommendations we saw that leaned into, at an end state, you know, more of a reliance on bioenergy. And we've seen that because of this new accounting, we just can't have it be a large part of our overall footprint. And so I think we've looked at the levers that we have available, and we've tried through these scenarios to give you all a sense of different portfolios that could manage that end state risk. But I do think that there are strong commonalities along the way that really, I think I've now heard multiple council members raise, that we should be emphasizing in our narrative as we go out and into the world. And your first question again, I'm sorry, can you recap that one for me?
So if you could clarify and restate and help us understand the scenario that represents, you know, the decommissioning of fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'll say broadly, every scenario has to include a decommissioning of some fossil infrastructure over time, right? There is the New York in 2050 will have less fossil infrastructure than it does now. Our scenario three is a more aggressive scenario in terms of kind of more aggressively looking at having less combustion. We're also going to draw forward a sensitivity. So that's not in these scenarios right now, that will look at what if we have, for the power sector specifically, what if we have no upgrades to any of the power sector fossil generators? You know, what if we don't have any hydrogen? What if we don't have any nuclear? So there are going to be additional sensitivities that I will share in 2 weeks. But I think the kind of the core scenario three is the one that's most closely aligned with an accelerated decommissioning.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And we still have a few more hands up. We've got Tom Falcone, Gil Quinones, Peter Iwanowitz, and Donna DeCarolis.
Right, should I go next or?
Please.
Okay. Well, first, I just want to thank you, Carl, because I've been involved in many planning studies like this, and I know how hard it is to actually extract out of all the data the really key points. And so, first, I want to thank you for really illustrating for us in red and bold and green. It takes a lot of work, and I imagine you went through a large number of drafts to really pull out what's key about these scenarios and what does it mean and how actionable each one of them is. So thank you for your efforts and the efforts of the team. You know, one comment, I do agree with Dennis on the need to focus on the build out of the transmission and distribution infrastructure. I would just mention, though, there are a lot of ongoing efforts in that area. There's efforts at FERC right now. It's a key focus of the Biden administration to focus on transmission planning. There's a docket due there. And the PSC has done a bunch of work on transmission and distribution planning. I know even here on Long Island, we had identified a need for another export cable. And bids on that export cable to achieve 9 gigawatts of offshore wind, which is less than what we're going to need, but it's what the current goal is. Those bids are due October 10th. So there's a lot going on there. I just wanted to mention it. My question, getting beyond the statements, was really to the point that's come up in your remarks. You mentioned at a high level, and I know we'll get into it more, some of the high level numbers, 20 gigawatts of offshore wind, I think it was 60 gigawatts of solar, 20 gigawatts of storage that's 4 to 8 hour duration. And then the big hole, which is the long duration storage, you mentioned 100 hour plus, and certainly there are, to make an electric grid work, you have to be prepared for events that can be multiple days. And that's the real gap. There's a lot of potential technology there. Nobody knows which ones are gonna be right, green hydrogen or other things that are out there. I guess my question though is, can you give us what the order of magnitude of that is? In my mind, 60 yeah. gigawatts of solar, 20 wind, 20. But, you know, what do you think that need for long duration is? What does that look like?
Yeah, and I do have a slide on that. But it's, you know, what we're seeing is on the order of another 20 gigawatts of zero emission firm resource. it's a tens of gigawatt scale. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Gil? All
right. Who was next? Hi. Gil, okay.
Thank you. Yeah. Carl, thank you very much for this work. Thank you to you and your team. Just to amplify what Tom had mentioned, I encourage you and your team to reach out to the utility advisory group. I think that's what we're calling them, the New York ISO, entities like EPRI, NREL or PNNL, you know, our two national labs that are looking at grid transformation requirements. It would be nice if we can come up with, you know, how will the grid need to evolve under each of the scenarios, right? What is the grid modernization roadmap to enable and to help facilitate the each of the scenarios, because there will be a lot, you know, the grid will have to change, and there will be a lot of investment needed in the grid. That's number one. Number two, under any scenario, we need to maintain reliability and resiliency, right? Reliability is the performance of the grid under normal conditions, and resiliency is the performance of the grid and its ability to bounce back under abnormal conditions, such as severe weather events, cyber physical security. So I think we can make this analysis really robust by, working very closely with our utility advisory groups and other thought leaders in terms of grid modernization.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that. Great points.
Peter?
Sorry, trying to find the unmute button. Thanks, Sarah. Appreciate it. Carl, wonderful presentation as always. I have a couple of, maybe they're too granular, but they get at the point that I think Bob Howarth was just making and a point that Gil was just making about the sort of need to you know, deal with transportation sector emissions. And in scenario sort of 3 and 4, to what extent do you, the modeling sort of, does it continue to project the early analysis that we got from E3 in the summer of 2020 that we'll have more vehicles on New York roads, particularly passenger vehicles, than we currently have in 2050? Or are we starting to appreciate that the only way to hit these climate goals is to have fewer vehicles?
Yeah, no, I don't have the vehicle count on me, Peter, so let me get back to you. We are in scenario 4 really looking at mode shifting in a much more significant way than we've seen in the past, in the order of a 15% reduction in VMT. I'll have to see kind of how that's translated into vehicle ownership. But, you know, our key indicator are the vehicles on the road, and we're having to see a substantial shift in the scenario 4. And again, that's getting people out of single occupancy cars and into biking, walking, and other modes of transit.
Right. Great. Thanks. Yeah, I look forward to seeing that number. That's always been sort of disturbing in the back of my head that we would go through this entire process and have more vehicles on our roads in 2050 than we have now. The other thing I was sort of asking about, and I've raised this in other meetings, is the relationship of vehicle to grid technology. I know everybody's concerned about load and all these electric vehicles, but you know, on a day like today, my car is charging up here at home off of solar power, PV rooftop. I'd love to be able to discharge that power back into my home at night. The vehicle I have doesn't do that, but with Ford making an announcement, I know that Gil and the team has been working with school districts and vehicle to grid with school buses. You know, how much is the modeling sort of contemplating the energy storage component of what motor vehicles will become? Because whatever number of vehicles we have on the road, if they're battery powered, they're going to not be just cars and vehicles, they're going to be energy storage devices. So
there's absolutely a significant amount of vehicle both flexibility and then exploration of how it can those mobile batteries can help to serve the grid. And so the reason why we're able to have
a doubling of energy and a nearly doubling of peak is because of those, you know, the active smart charging. And then we'll be looking at a sensitivity of even more aggressive load flexibility and vehicle interactivity. So that'll be one of our sensitivities to really show even further promise around flattening, you know, and having a better utilization of the wires that we're going to have to build.
Great, thanks. I'll look forward to more of this stuff being unveiled for us in 2 weeks, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, some of it's in this deck, so I want to encourage you once we publish it to dig in, but we'll have more as well.
Thanks.
Donna?
Thanks, Sarah. Thank you, Carl. Carl, please don't view my short list of questions as all the questions that I have, because as you said, there's a lot here. So I look forward to this being posted so we can dig in more. So thank you. One question, I have a few. So one is, I'm curious how the dual fuel or kind of the hybrid heating solution that was talked about last meeting is included, or is it included? I think it is somehow. So I was interested in that.
Yep.
Do you want me to keep going, or should I? I'll keep going. And
yeah, go for it.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you. And then the second one, it kind of related to Dennis's, but I'll just add it. It said in a different way. I was curious about this. You know, so the pace of transition. You know, the varying pace of transition. It's all transitioning substantially. A lot of electrification, as we've talked about, and I'm curious, how do we know the distribution side of the transmission is ready? How do we match the pace of transition with the readiness of the local systems? You know, we think about old neighborhoods. I live in one. How do we know they're ready? So if I'm mandated to convert, how do I know my system's ready? And then and I was also, I know we've talked about this as well, consumer cost, and I know it's going to be a cost benefit analysis, but this is such substantial transition. And I think this goes to Gil's comments about getting the utility consultation group involved. I think that's really important. All of us as utilities are really focused on consumer affordability along with reliability and resilience. And so I think it's important to be able to understand what would this cost a consumer, you know. I just think it's something that's important for them to know. So with that, I guess I'll say thank you very much and turn it back to you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so let me try to address those. Some of those were interrelated. So in terms of the hybrid heating, that is in our scenario two, and I have a slide, which I think we'll have time to get to, where I compare the grid peak across each of our scenarios, and you'll see there's a substantially lower peak in scenario two. And that's because of this hybridization. In terms of kind of pace of transition and distribution needs, we will be quantifying the kind of scope and scale of distribution needs at a high level. Again, this is not a detailed utility by utility plan. We look zonally and look at how load will change and grow and the shape of that load and come up with an estimate of what that distribution cost might be. We absolutely need to engage with the joint utility work group. I mean, I see this as a starting point for that conversation. And I think you're exactly right that we need to not just look at kind of what the stock turnover of the appliance is and think about the cost implications, both to kind of how to buy those appliances and the cost on the system, but look at the equivalent of a stock turnover. Like, what is the infrastructure plan for building out all the local wires? And, you know, that needs to be follow on. I think what this work does is gives us a sense of what the time constant is in the system, right? How quickly is transitioning happening? And we need to unpack, you know, how will infrastructure need to change and what are going to be those critical path questions? You know, is it going to be in our urban centers and thinking about the old building stock? Is that going to be the critical path? Is it going to be in our kind of more distant and desperate rural communities? Maybe at the end of a radial line. I think that those are the right questions that we're going to have to unpack and figure out, you know, for each community, what does this look like, and what type of roadmap will they need to have. And to be clear, the panels weren't calling for mandates in the next decade. Really, mandates, I think they recommended happen later. So what we see in these early years are about how can we incentivize consumer choice and empower consumers to make those decisions.
And that more likely than not means we're going to be needing to go after regions of the state where you can see early adoption, you know, and maybe it's because their home has a 200 amp panel. Maybe it's because the infrastructure is there to be able to absorb a new large commercial building that's switching to a ground source heat pump. So I think we're going to see it play out in the state in different regions and in different ways. But it's certainly going to have to be the case that we are empowering those choices to happen. And then consumer costs, obviously it's a theme that we're hearing clearly. You know, we'll need to think about for those net costs, you know, how we can translate those into ways that we can understand them, right? So what does it look like if it's spread over the entire economy, right? We are a trillion plus economy. We can absorb a lot. So that's one view of how those costs might play out. But then let's think about it in terms of energy infrastructure and, you know, what's the cost of these transformations as compared to what we're investing in our energy infrastructure, you know, business as usual, right? We have an old system that we have to upgrade over time. If you looked at New York City's pathways, that was an interesting lens that they brought to bear, was to say, we need to upgrade these buildings and this infrastructure. We're going to be spending billions of dollars both on fuel, but also on the infrastructure itself. So what is this incremental cost in that context? And then I think, you know, how can we bring a lens that brings it more down to the household? You know, we are, again, aren't able, because we just don't have specificity of policies, to articulate specific rate designs. But we're going to do the best we can to be able to translate this into different lenses of what these costs might look like.
Thanks, Carl.
Yeah. So I think I hit your issues. Thanks for those great comments.
Carl, I see Gil's and Dennis's hands are up, but those might be legacy hands. So I might suggest that we move on to your next set of slides and see if we can get through those. I think it'll have good information for folks.
Yeah, so I'm going to unpack through the next set of slides a little bit more and maybe address some of the questions. I'll try to do it quickly. Sarah, how much time as my timekeeper?
I just need, I would say, 5 minutes at the end for next steps.
Okay, thank you. All right, next slide. And so this is more of a bookkeeping slide just to show each of the scenarios, what the limits are, how they go at them. There's nothing particularly new. It's just laying them all out. You'll obviously see that the green, which is our scenario 4, goes beyond our limit. And our scenario 1 that we know fell short, and we made up for that in the rest. Next slide, please. So what I want to unpack for you all, which I think is a particularly useful end, is the final energy. And what is the distribution of final energy over time? What is the arc of those curves? So I've got a few slides here that look at final energy. On the left are the absolute TBTUs, so that's the energy unit all in one. On the right is the percentage as it as each of those energy sources. And why that's important to show that is that you'll see that we've really bent the curve on end use. We are hypothesizing, and we have kind of our numbers to show it, that we can cut final energy in half through this plan. And that's pretty much true across all scenarios. And most of that is predicated on the efficiency that's built into electrification. So it's not just that we're doing conventional building shells and more deep retrofits. It's not just that we are also reducing, you know, VMT, which means less fuel needs to be burned. It's just the act of electrifying our appliances and electrifying our vehicles is a much more inherently efficient system. And so even in our scenario 2, which is our strategic use of low carbon fuels, you see that we electrify nearly 70%. So it's going from 20% today up to 70% in the future. So that's what I meant by some of the commonalities, is that we see deep electrification over time. So what you'll see is the difference between the scenarios is a little bit that endpoint, but also the rate at which we actualize that. In our scenario 2, we see hydrogen could play a role on the order of 10%. We don't, even in this strategic use of low carbon fuels, we're not seeing those delivered fuels as being the dominant source for end use. And we are seeing bioenergy across our various uses, predominantly for aviation, as an important piece, up to almost 15% of our final energy use. You'll see that in all cases, natural gas is a significant change over time. You'll see that in this scenario, there is RNG that's being mixed in. And that's, again, very targeted uses for, again, some of those large users that need high quality type of heat. So that's our strategic low carbon fuel use narrative. Next slide. For scenario three, which was really accelerating away from combustion, you'll see that bioenergy is really down to almost noise here. It's around 2%, where we saw that there were still some end uses that likely needed that type of high density energy source. You know, one of the paradoxes in part is that we are still seeing that it's going to be hard to electrify much of our aviation fleet. So if we're not leaning on the bioenergy to do that, we may still see some fossil combustion in our aviation fleet. We also see half as much hydrogen in this scenario. That's really targeting fuel cell use. So there is no combustion of hydrogen in this scenario, and its use shrinks. We see that electrification is both accelerated. You'll see there's a little bump in 2030 where we have to see acceleration to hit our 2030 goal. And we see yet higher level, up to 75% electrification in this scenario. Next slide. And so then we layer them to make our scenario four. And so we see slightly more hydrogen, slightly more bioenergy, equivalent, if not higher amount of electrification in order to go beyond 85. Next slide. So I want to take a moment to look at gas demand. And there might be a click through here. Can you try clicking once more? Ah, thank you. Back one. That's it. So we see across all of our scenarios, there's going to be a substantial shift in the end use gas demand. Again, given our overall accounting, it's an inevitable outcome that we're going to have to see a reduction in fossil gas use. And our AP recommendations, which is that top line, did a substantial push out to 2050, but ended up backloading that transition. And what we saw in 2030, they hit our goals, we're going to have to accelerate that more quickly than what the AP recommendations brought forward. And so, you know, we have around 1,000 TBTUs of gas and end uses today, and we end, you know, anywhere between 100 and 200. And what does that end state look like? That's what this graph on the right shows. And so across all scenarios, we see it being either half or mostly hydrogen, and then a small and very specific use of any RNG. So this just gives you a sense of the magnitude of the gas transition that will need to unfold if we're going to embrace the full accounting of both upstream emissions and counting all of our biogenic CO2. Next slide. So I want to talk a little bit about what the electric system looks like. As I mentioned, across all scenarios, we see that we're going to have to double. Our original AP recommendation, again, backloaded some of the electrification. We're having to accelerate it and bring it forward. And so we see, you know, as early as 2025, we start to deviate from our reference case in terms of load growth, and it only accelerates over time. We also see that to make the hydrogen, for it to be green hydrogen, we have to actually make it with electricity. And so we see a meaningful amount of electricity on the order of 40 terawatt hours as compared to load, which is getting above 300. So I wouldn't say that the hydrogen electrolysis is a dominant new load, but it is a meaningful new load on the system. It also provides for us some interesting flexibility. And depending on assumptions around utilization of electrolyzers, we can see that creating hydrogen actually helps us to balance the grid. And we can make that hydrogen during times when we have very cheap solar and potentially less need in the summer as we put more and more efficient heat pumps and we become more of a winter-focused system. We can better utilize the full capacity of the grid and balance seasonally with that hydrogen use, or in this case, hydrogen generation, which will turn into use. Next slide. So looking at the peak, that is one differentiating factor when we look at different scenarios. So as I mentioned, we have, you know, nearly doubling of peak, even with very aggressive, flexible loads. We know that the peak could be higher if we do unmanaged electrification. You know, we've seen other studies that could take the peak up above 60. We also have been looking at sensitivities that have even more aggressive flexible load? How can we really animate every type of end use? How do we have batteries acting both stationary and mobile? And we think there is the opportunity to actually have that peak be even lower. And that, to us, sets an agenda for innovation, sets an agenda for creating market structures that will allow us to realize this peak management. And what I mentioned earlier is that scenario two, because of the very strategic use of delivered fuels, we're able to substantially reduce peak. And so we'll be seeing how that plays out in terms of cost trade-offs. That if we can use our strategic low-carbon fuels, we might be able to save on building out our wires. And that has both cost implications, but also implications in terms of practically siting and building wires, both in communities and larger transmission systems. Next slide, please. So I think we were asked about, what does this electric generation system look like? This is a focus out in the future in 2050. We've done a lot of good work with the power grid study, with our clean energy standard white paper, where we really focused on 2030 and to a degree 2040. What's really novel here is looking all the way out. And so that's where you see this scale of 60 gigawatts of solar, scale of 20 gigawatts of offshore wind. We see a scale of 20 gigawatts of land-based wind. We think some of that may come from our neighbors, both in PJM and in Canada. So you'll see there's a small slice of potentially some imports of wind. A vast majority will be built in New York by New Yorkers. And the question is, how can we site this magnitude? How can we do it in a way that's respectful of the many uses of our land? But you'll see across our scenarios, I think there was also a question of, do we see a substantial change in the grid across our scenarios? Really, the reality is that the magnitude of the installed capacity is going to have to be very similar. We're talking about, 140 gigawatts of installed capacity. These have low capacity factors, so that obviously it's a much larger installed capacity than the actual peak load. We need more in scenario four. We are talking up to 160,000. But they are really shades of the same system. It's going to be one dominated by wind and solar. We do see hydro playing in a really critical balancing role. And then there was the question of what's the scale of these new zero carbon firm resources? And you'll see here it's on the scale of 20 gigawatts. In order to supply us during those winter doldrums that we've analyzed, where we look at multiple days in the winter of extreme cold snap when we have snow in our solar panels, and how do we manage that? That's what we're going to need in terms of the scale of our zero carbon firm resources. Next slide. I don't know, are we frozen again? Oh, there we go. So that was a look at the gigawatts. This takes us a look at the actual energy. And so this allows you to kind of rescale a little bit and think about what's the contribution to our needs. And so we're really seeing kind of some good balance in this jointly optimized system between wind and solar. They have complementary profiles, complementary risks, in the sense that we often have wind at night. We often have wind strong wind in the winter. And so we see that through this jointly optimized transmission, storage, generation modeling we've done, that we're able to see that we bring on large amounts, a third of our system being solar, a third of it being wind. You'll see that the zero carbon firm resources provide very little energy. Really, they are there to provide us for those limited days when we don't have solar and wind and water. So we're talking about a meaningful amount of very low utilization capacity that's there as our insurance policy to make sure that our lights stay on. Next slide, please. Okay, so I did promise last time I would unpack bioenergy. I know this is I want to respect the request to not dwell on the last 15%, but I also know that this is an important topic, at least to understand what our team has assumed. And so I got just a couple of slides here, and then I'm going to wrap up. So our feedstock supply, we looked at sources at the federal level, DOE's billion tons. We've also looked at NYSERDA studies. We've done over the decades in-state potential studies for bioenergy. We also have some new work that we'll be publishing with this specific pathways analysis that we've done with other consultants. And then we adjusted all of those rich studies based on what our advisory panels have given us over the past months and some of the academic partners that have been brought into this dialogue. And so what we look at is that we, as we allocate feedstocks, we look at several variables. We look at what's the production cost of these fuels as compared to the fossil fuel prices, and what's their overall opportunity to reduce emissions. Because we're now counting CO2 emissions from the combustion of these fuels, they are not zero emission, but we do see that they drop emissions. Something like RNG actually has one of the greatest emission reductions because we're now doubling what the fossil fuel footprint is. And so RNG has around half of the carbon footprint of its fossil point. So that's, these are the variables that our team has taken into account. So it's around cost, it's around ability to actually abate emissions. And then some of the other principles that we looked at, we look at how biofuels would be substituting for their existing fossil. And we can't just look at what that footprint is today. We have to look out to 2050 as we deeply electrify, how much might be needed still for the hard to electrify appliances. And we're not going to necessarily overbuild now if we think we're going to electrify in the future. So that also puts one of the parameters around how we scale our bioenergy use. So it's both around feedstock availability, but potentials for their end use over the long run. And then in terms of liquid fuels, just as an example, we look at relative fuel costs as we think about, is it a better use of our limited resources, for example, as a renewable diesel versus a renewable jet fuel? So I have some boxes here that I won't go through in detail, but each scenario has their own approach and their own philosophy that I have spoken to previously. So next slide. Just want to give you a sense of what scenario two looks like quickly. So this is the GBTUs of the higher biofuel scenario. You'll see in a system today of 3,000 GBTUs that will end up at 1,500. We're talking about only tens of GBTUs. And so we see from our agriculture and forest residues on the order of 70 GBTUs, some of our waste available energies on the order of 40, and then some select grown biomass that's, looking at what can be sustainably grown that wouldn't displace other end uses only in state on the order of around 100 GBTUs. And so how that flows in our system in 2030 as a snapshot is in a renewable diesel. So as we electrify that fleet, we can do some substitution along the way and some renewable natural gas. When we look out further to 2050, we see in this scenario, it then begins to substitute for the aviation fuel, which has an even harder time. Next slide. So this is the last kind of end state snapshot looking at 2030 and 2040 across our scenarios. So we see substantially more GBTUs in our scenario two, but still, let's keep in the context, a system today of 3,000 GBTUs, we're talking about 300 out into the future. And we see that there's a transition in scenario two, again, with that renewable distillate in the early years as we electrify over time. And then in the end state, having more hydrogen, having more jet fuel, that would be in our low carbon fuel use. You'll see that scenario three has minuscule, very targeted amount of bioenergy and hydrogen use. And again, that would be targeted in a moving away from combustion, so that hydrogen would most likely be used in applications such as fuel cells. So that's the whirlwind tour. I'm out of time. I think that's it. Next slide, please. Yeah, so I'm going to pause there. So we've got probably another 80 slides for the sectoral deep dives, which we can talk about next time. So Sarah, back to you.
Great. Thank you, Carl. Do you want to take any questions? We do have a couple hands. Maybe it would be better to take the questions on the 14th, or if council members want to send questions my way, I would be happy to help chase down the answers between now and then as well. So if I can ask the CADMIS team to go to the very last slide, I think it's 136. And this is just our
you know, our next steps slide. And so just want to talk about the next steps that we've got through the end of the year. As a reminder, I just want to make it clear to folks that might not have been at the previous meeting in September. Just want to highlight the draft scoping plan approach. So rather than selecting a single pathway to achieve the state's goals, the draft scoping plan will present all of the scenarios that are being examined along with their full cost and benefit. Obviously, the scenarios build on the recommendations from the panels and working groups, and as you know, have been informed by both the council member feedback as well as feedback from the Climate Justice Working Group. Following release of the draft at the end of the year, there's going to be a public input period where New Yorkers will be able to weigh in with their thoughts and preferences with respect to the scenarios. And then the council will consider that feedback in their deliberations and discussions for the final scoping plan, which is due to be released January 1st, 2023. And so with that, just as kind of the high level kind of approach to the scoping plan, I wanted to go over the schedule again. This should look pretty similar to what it has in the past slides or past meetings. Just to quickly go over it, as we've heard a couple times today, the plan is to come back at the October 14th meeting and have the full modeling results presented from the integration analysis. We're also going to be doing a walkthrough of the draft scoping plan at that meeting, and that meeting is going to be a little bit longer. We've scheduled that for 4 hours. The intention is that based on the feedback that we get at the meeting, staff will take, I would say, 7 to 10 days, depending on the feedback, to draft the scenario information to get that into the draft scoping report, draft scoping plan. That would be designed to meet more of your expectations based on the feedback at the 14th meeting. But we'd get the draft to you at the end of October. We'd allow a week or so of breathing room for council members to initiate their review. But to gather feedback, we're proposing that we'd use a similar process to what we did for the scenario designs, where we'd hold small group sessions organized by topic area. That we'd hold over the first 2 weeks of November. And then as we did in the integration analysis, small group sessions, any substantive feedback, we would reflect at the subsequent public meetings. So we'd be transparent on that. And so I would just say, if this approach is amenable to you, we'll be reaching out to start scheduling these sessions, because I expect that might be a bit of a challenge, having the trying to basically accommodate everyone's desire to be on what I imagine would be a lot of these small group sessions. And so if that works, I would suggest that we get out a survey with available time slots and areas of greatest interest so we can get that feedback. following that, the November 16th meeting would be about providing some of that feedback that we had heard from the council members and saying, this is our plan for how we're going to address it in the scoping plan. We'd also hear a report out on the job study, as I believe Carl mentioned earlier. And then the plan would be to take the feedback we heard at that November meeting and to turn around a revised draft by early December. We're looking at about the 3rd is what we'd be targeting, to give the council members 10 days to review prior to meeting on December 13th to take action, well, to discuss the changes that have been made and to potentially take action on the draft scoping plan. And so apologize for going through that so quickly, but just wanted to get all of that in. I guess if there are concerns about initiating feedback on the draft scoping plan through the small group sessions, I would ask maybe just if we can, you know, if folks would voice that now and we can, you know, try to think of something else. But right now our preference is to start scheduling those as best we can.
I see there are a couple hands up. We are just about at time, but I see that Dennis had his hand up, as well as Raya and Peter.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Sarah. This was more I was trying to make a point on load forecasts with Carl, but I can follow up with that.
And at the 14th, at the meeting on the 14th of October, we can also take additional questions there too.
All right, fantastic. My question, and you can also perhaps answer that later, or actually now, if you know, how will the process for the criteria and articulation of the disadvantaged communities piece flow into this timeline?
So as I understand it, the short story is I need to work a little bit more with the folks on the Climate Justice Working Group. I understand that they were aiming for a November vote on the disadvantaged communities criteria. I'm not sure. I've heard that maybe that it would slip a little bit from there. And so I would say that if we don't yet have the finalized criteria, we won't have the finalized criteria. If we have the initial criteria they're putting out for public comment in time, we will certainly incorporate it into the scoping plan, the draft scoping plan. And if we do not have it, I would expect that we would try to represent where the Climate Justice Working Group is in that planning and try to get that incorporated as quickly as we can following that.
Sarah, Peter? I have a brief process question for you. You had mentioned, should we be just holding back our questions and starting up the meeting on the 14th with additional questions for Carl after his sort of last segment of slides? I'm just concerned that if we ask questions and the broader public isn't aware of what we're asking in responses, they lose that dialogue.
So how about this? If we can maybe ask for some of your questions in advance, and then we can be prepared to... I would assume that some of you are going to have similar questions, and then maybe when we start the meeting on the 14th, when we're talking about the integration analysis, we can hit some of those questions there, the most common questions. And of course, we can always reflect any additional feedback at additional meetings or to post information if we just run out of time to do it in these public meetings. But I would say we do it similar to